We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
Go on without me. Just go!
A good soldier never leaves a man behind.
Because I wouldn't give you 2 cents for all your fancy rules if behind them they didn't have a little bit of plain, ordinary, everyday kindness.
Life, finds a way.
Welcome to Silver Screen Biases. Each week we pick a movie off of IMDb's Top 250 and dig into it. We're examining truth claims in critically acclaimed movies while also examining our own biases. I'm Nelson.
This is Jeff.
Isn't this the part where you say, and this week we're...
with Connor.
Connor. Welcome back. Hat trick. It's a
welcome
hockey
back,
tournament.
Connor. This week the movie is...
No Country for Old Men.
This episode is brought to you by our community on Patreon. They make this show happen and you can help. Links to our Patreon and merchandise are in the show notes. Now back to the show.
Welcome back, Connor.
Welcome back, Connor.
Three-peat. Yeah. How you been, man?
I'm good. Thanks for having me again.
Good. Absolutely. We're just desperate, honestly, at this point.
The only person that answers our emails anymore.
Makes me feel real good. Thanks, guys.
No. You have been a lovely guest previously. We're glad to have you back. So before we're going to re-ask you some of our interview questions, just in case listeners haven't listened to the previous episodes. But just in general, what you've been up to since the last time we've talked, which is some... shoot some bull. What's been going on with you, Connor?
Well, the last time I was here, I had just moved to Colorado for the Army. Still there.
Mm-hmm.
Currently...
Colorado's still there?
Colorado is still there. As far as I know, I haven't been there in a week.
Yeah.
So...
that's fair.
But from what I understand, it's still a state for now. But other than that, just kind of...
do something about that.
I wouldn't be opposed. But yeah, I'm just kind of working and... doing my Army thing.
And what's your role in the military? What's your title?
So I'm a sergeant in the Army, and I am a combat medic.
Combat medic. Oh. Awesome. So again, this is specifically for the listeners who have not listened to the previous episodes with you on. We're going to ask you a couple questions just to get to know you, and these answers may help us be more familiar with you as we get into some of the topics from this movie, which is No Country for Old Men. So first off, Connor, how would you describe yourself politically? Do you have any biases when it comes to politics?
I hate all of them is my main bias. I, like I said before, still pretty libertarian. Again, yeah. Not as much as this anarcho-capitalist over here. But
just to clarify, it's Nelson, not Jeff. You're talking about Nelson.
Correct. Correct.
No, okay. Just
viva la libertad, carajo.
Yeah. At some point, our listeners may get confused and think I'm a libertarian.
No, my main opinion is that the government just needs to leave people alone. That there is a purpose for government, but they're very much overstepping their bounds at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, moving on.
Again, hold on real quick, because we did touch on my politics there. Jeff, for the audience at home, what are your politics?
How have we described it the best? I'm very not neutral, but just kind of I like to stand right outside the door of politics. I'm interested about what's going on because I know in some ways directly and indirectly it affects me.
Yeah.
But in the same time, I have a hard time putting full trust and confidence in the people in Washington. So I'm intrigued with it, and I'm hopeful that there's people in government positions that are doing good things. And part of me believes in it because I have to, or believes just because of that idea, like it's going to be there. So I hope it works. If they're going to be there, I hope it works. I don't know the pilot on my plane, but I hope they're going to fly it well. Like that type of mentality. Like just, I'm going to be here. I'm going to live in it. But yeah, just politically, I'm here to learn more and just to try to understand more about it. I don't adhere to any party. Yeah, I think that's the nutshell.
Yeah, apolitical.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah,
we'll call it that. All right, Connor, religiously, do you have any biases or where would you stand when it comes to all things faith or of anything in that topic?
So again, pretty much the same as I was last time I was here. Grew up going to church every single Sunday, kind of fell out of that. Haven't been to church in a long time. Don't necessarily not believe in something, but I don't really know what that is yet. I will say that over the past few months, I've been feeling this internal struggle of whether or not I want to go back to church or not. More so for the sense of community. Moving out to Colorado, I have just felt kind of lonely.
Yeah.
And it's just something that I've been thinking about maybe trying to go back to. So, but
I'm sure there's got to be at least one good church in your city.
I would assume so.
Fingers crossed. Nelson, just to recap, it Happy New Year, by the way.
Happy New Year.
We'll get into a little bit more of that in a little bit. Yeah. But since this is the first episode of the year, we are kind of intentionally recapping your and I's biases as well.
Yeah.
So, Nelson, where do you stand when it comes to faith, religious, cults, conspiracies, you know, mind warping and stuff?
Sure. I would say that I'm a Christian, a Protestant Christian, more in the Reformed tradition, but not like everything out of the Reformed tradition. I'm Calvin-ish. More than anything, what's most important to me when, like, evaluating my faith is making sure that I'm not fitting my priors into what I read into scripture, but trying to reform my, the way I look at the world based on what I see that scripture teaching us is the proper way to look at the world. And of course, that's going to come, like, you know, two people are going to read the same piece of scripture and might come away with different conclusions about that. So that's a constant refining process that requires constant education and like thinking about what you're thinking about. But that's, you know, to put it in a word, Christian.
Cool. And for me, I would, if I had to put in a word, I'd also say Christian. Born and raised Christian family, Baptist for a while. Sort of with politics too. Like, I don't like adhering to a denomination.
Okay.
They all have, to my knowledge, they all have some inconsistencies or just things that I don't necessarily jive with. I don't think we need denominations.
No.
But obviously, but we can't change that. So I just, when it comes to the Calvinist Arminianist debate, like, honestly, I'm not real well versed in both either of them. I'm familiar enough to like, I went to Christian college. I know what they are, but like in general, like I don't think either one is 100% foolproof. And like, I don't think either one's going to be the right answer 100%. Like they're both going to have some inerrancies being that they're both of those are structures that have been structured by human versus God. Mm-hmm. Like there's going to be some inerrancies. Like the reason that there is a debate is because there's room for debates. Like, I don't want to necessarily put my faith in one side or the other. I just believe that Jesus Christ died to save our souls and that we're designed to spread love and, you know, build his kingdom. Mm-hmm. You know, like for me, it's that simple. I enjoy sometimes when it gets more complex, but just simply like love people, love others.
Yeah.
And just, you know, and just be a good human.
Right. So, and I, you know, in a similar way that for you, both your religious and political biases have kind of a similarity in your overall, like, I'm just really more focused at the top level stuff and that all those gritty nuances don't interest you. Right. And I'm really kind of the opposite where it's like, I want to get into all these little nooks and crannies and nuances and see what people way smarter than me have written about them and what people said in response to that. And, I like that stuff. Yeah.
And I do enjoy learning about that. Just like I do enjoy learning about American history.
Yeah.
I enjoy diving into theology and stuff like that. But in general, like I've not had a moment in my faith where I've been at the point where I'm like, I don't know. I need to pick a side. Like for me, it's just always been like,
oh, sure.
Why are we arguing? We're on the same team. If we believe that Jesus wins, like, why are there rifts? Like, why do we have to pick sides?
Yeah.
Well, like, I get, in the same sense, like I get that there's two. I get why there's two interpretations or more than two.
But two major camps and several like, smaller camps.
But just
I'd say that it's just like whether you are libertarian, socialist, communist, monarchist, whatever, it's going to largely affect the way you understand the world.
Right.
Once you get into some of these nooks and crannies, it's surprising how much of a small thing can have such a massive impact on your worldview.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things I find most interesting about it. Yeah. But yeah, that's the that's why we are the way we are on our religious biases.
Connor, back to you. Describe yourself when it comes to movies. So do you have a favorite film? Do you have a favorite director? What's the last movie you've seen? Just give us a little bit of like, when it comes to the silver screen, what are some things you enjoy, genres, or just, yeah, I know those are vague, multiple questions, but like, how would you describe yourself when it comes to the silver screen?
Well, my favorite movie of all time is Back to the Future Part One.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that when I'm watching movies, I try not to analyze them too much. I'm more in it for the enjoyment of the movie. I just want to get lost in the story.
Yeah.
The last movie that I watched was Leave the World Behind, the new Netflix movie about the Chinese cyber attack, or maybe, I don't even know if it was Chinese. Just,
no,
it's pretty ambiguous.
In the political discourse outside of, like in our real world political discourse, such an event is expected to come from the Chinese if it comes. But in the movie, I think that they're ambiguous.
But that movie was decent. Other than that, the last movie I saw before that was The Holdovers. Highly recommend.
Yeah, I need to see that.
Yeah.
And then I saw Napoleon. That one's, it's all right.
Really?
It's just okay.
Really?
Quick review. It's there's good scenes. The battle scenes are pretty good. The story is fairly entertaining, but there's a lot of really boring, dull parts where they just dive into Napoleon's, for lack of a better term, Napoleon complex. Mm-hmm. And it gets kind of boring.
I could be down for that, to be honest. But I've also heard, and you said it earlier in a text message to me, that there's a lot of gratuitous nudity.
No, not gratuitous nudity. Just a lot of sexual encounters.
Okay.
But not nudity necessarily.
Okay. Was there less or more nudity than Oppenheimer?
Less.
Okay. Really? Cool. That surprises me.
Nice.
Less nudity than Oppenheimer, more sexual situations.
Right.
The nudity in Oppenheimer was not needed.
But that's kind of my movie.
In fact, to punctuate how unneeded it was, in China, there is no nudity in Oppenheimer, and that scene is still in the movie.
Yeah, they CGI. It's the only CGI in that film. Yeah. A CGI address.
Onto her. For the Chinese
release. I did not know that.
Yeah, Florence Pugh's character for the Chinese version.
They protected her dignity.
They CGI'd a dress. Now, do they CGI clothes on him? Because technically we never see...
He's shirtless.
And in the scene where they're sitting in the chairs, he's also naked, but you don't see...
He's got his leg crossed.
His groin. Yeah. He's got do they CGI shorts on him?
I
don't
think so.
Okay.
I think the CGI was
just for the female.
Was just to protect her dignity, not his. Okay. I mean, his dignity was protected. Right. You don't get to see his Ghibli bits.
Ghibli bits.
But that's me in a cinematic nutshell. I try to go to the movies probably once a month.
Cinematic nutshell.
In all,
miming doesn't work really well on an audio only format.
Nelson, do we need to? You and I talk about our film.
Yeah, tell the audience what you. Because it's changed over the last year.
It has. I've consumed so many more movies in the last 12 months.
Yeah.
15 months. Oh, it's almost a year. A little over a year.
Yeah.
I'm a movie liker.
Yeah.
I don't want everyone to consider myself a movie buff, but I've there's definitely a lot of movies out there that are classics I still haven't seen that we'll eventually get to.
Yeah.
But my favorite director is Christopher Nolan.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a movie from him that I've not just been amazed by.
Right.
Have you seen Tenet?
Love it.
I could not get into that one.
So far, and I have not seen all of Nolan's films. I'm just completely transparent. There's one specifically, I don't have his list up right away, but like I think there's one on the list I haven't seen. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but Prestige so far is the one that I can think of is probably my least favorite.
Did he do Memento?
He did do Memento, and Memento's awesome.
Un Momento.
I think there is one on his list I haven't seen. But
if you'd like to hear more about Jeff's thoughts on The Prestige,
previous episode
with Doc Dixon, Brother Clones.
Yes. I like to watch a lot of different films. With this podcast, I've never watched anime outside of Pokemon before this podcast.
I believe it's pronounced Pokemans.
Pokemans, Pocket Monsters. But no, we've watched two Ghibli films, and I've enjoyed those. So yeah, I'm interested in all film. I have a couple that I enjoy more.
Yeah.
But in general, like, I'm open to watching anything if it's entertaining.
Yeah.
I'm not a tough critic. It takes a lot for there to be a movie that just irritates me. I can dislike a movie, but still say it's a good movie. It takes a lot for me to go, that's a horrible movie.
Yeah.
like, and we've had that conversation in previous episodes. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, I'll rank it high as far as like film critique goes, but I still didn't enjoy it.
Right.
But I still see value in it.
Have you seen Rubber?
No, I've not heard of Rubber.
It's a movie about a sentient,
based on a real world event.
It's about a sentient tire that rolls around and blows people's heads up with its mind.
Mm-hmm. Are you serious?
And while you look up Rubber on your computer, because I know you can't not after such a brilliant synopsis, I too am a chucklehead movie liker. Over the last several years, as I've gotten more into like the edge case questions and theology and politics, and understood these how it impacts worldview so much, as I watched movies, I would get frustrated with things that I see on screen that are improperly capturing and simplifying things. And that's kind of part of where the idea for this show came from, is because all of that bias, all of our political and worldview biases bleed into cinema. But I'd say as far as like what I like in a movie, I want something, usually not one of the big, summer blockbusters is not going to be my favorite movie of the year. It's usually going to be something that comes from somebody that like has a lane and they stick in their lane and they do really good in that. So for example, like Wes Anderson, Guy Ritchie, the Coen brothers,
Scorsese,
where they have a thing that they do and they do that thing really well, I'm probably really going to enjoy that movie. And I get more, over the last year especially, I get more excited and curious about what a director is working on than what an actor is working on. If you're a blockbuster movie liker, which I don't downplay that at all, when it's like blockbuster stuff, I am curious about who the actor is going to be, right? So,
I have a question for you two, and stop me if this is something you've already discussed on a previous episode. But what was your favorite movie of 2023?
We've not discussed that.
Let's discuss it now. This is part of our 2023 wrap up.
Because I think I know mine.
Let's see.
Let me look up the list, because I've not seen. So you mentioned Napoleon. I've not seen Napoleon yet. Holdovers, I've not seen. I've also not seen Wonka.
These are the big ones from this year: Oppenheimer, Barbie, Guardians 3, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, John Wick 4, Quantumania, Super Mario, but oh, Dungeons and Dragons: Honor Among Thieves. That's mine.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I've watched that movie at least once a month since it's come out.
Fun movie.
Yeah. And then probably a close second, a very close second, would be Super Mario Brothers movie. I thought that was excellent. And even though I just talked about how I'm not like I like Oppenheimer for all the reasons I laid out earlier of like, this is what this director does really, really well, and he crushed it. But I don't know, Super Mario Brothers movie, Dungeons and Dragons movie, for like, both of those are just so much of my like childhood, and they did such a good job of taking those intellectual properties and adapting them in a way that was inviting to the casual, right? But also had so much in there for the diehard fan. So I thought those were excellent. But I think if we were to expand it of movies that I watched this year, for me it would be The Best Years of Our Lives.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. All right. It's probably going to come down to either Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, I Am a Marvel Head, or Oppenheimer. Mm. If I had to pick between those two, I'd probably pick Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer had the whole package, the composer, the beautiful cinematography, the story, the casting. I mean, if Robert Downey Jr. doesn't win an award for that movie, I'd be really surprised. I'd probably have to pick Oppenheimer. There's a lot that had come out this year that I haven't seen. I haven't, like, flaw. Like, I didn't see the new Elemental. I didn't see the Fast X.
Tetris was really good.
The Marvels was okay. I haven't seen Blue Beetle. I did not see Cocaine Bear. I did not
that
see.
That was a lot of fun.
I did not.
I didn't see it.
It was a lot of fun.
I have not seen Napoleon recommend yet. It.
Dumb Money was pretty fun, too.
Yeah.
I haven't
seen. What about you, Connor? What was your favorite movie of 2023?
I think mine would have to be the only movie that I saw multiple times in theaters.
Godzilla Plus One?
No, I want to see that. I haven't seen it yet.
It's minus one.
I've been hearing, whatever. I've been hearing incredible things about it.
Yeah, I want to see it. No, I think my favorite movie of the year would probably be Across the Spider-Verse.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was great. It was really good. Did you like it better than the previous one?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
For me, like, they're neck and neck. Like, I just think...
It's close, yeah. But I think Across the Spider-Verse was better.
Yeah. I'm really bummed they pushed back the third one. Because it was supposed to come out in March.
Mm-hmm.
When they announced Across the Spider-Verse, they announced the date for the third one, too, Beyond. And it was... But
yeah.
it's been pushed back indefinitely. It will come out, but there's just no date attached to it.
I watched Across the Spider-Verse. I liked it. Didn't love it. I thought it was... I didn't think it was quite as good as the first. Maybe I should give it a second shot. Well, I've got one more question. I know that wraps up our usual questions,
Yeah, go ahead.
It is New Year's Day as this releases. And so, Jeff, I'm going to start with you. What is your New Year resolution? What do you resolve to do in 2024?
I know it's become a lot more cliche recently, and I hear a lot of people like don't like making resolutions.
Sure.
And I, not to be cliche, but I'm not a resolution guy.
Yeah.
I do like making goals. I don't know if, are those the same thing?
It's the exact same thing.
Okay. Like,
this is my goal in 2024.
Like, for me, like, maybe I am more just being a pet peeve of like, oh, I don't want to be a...
Yeah.
Maybe
just
more
call it something different.
I'm being hipster. The only big thing for me for 2024 is I want to run a half marathon.
Mm. You going to walk the second half?
No, I will end at the end of the 13.1 miles. No, I wanted to do in 2023. Some life stuff came up that just made it complicated for us, for my wife and I to train. There is one in October of 2024 that we're signing up for. And so that's the big goal is
half marathon 2024.
Yeah. So throughout the year, cause the race is in October.
Yeah.
My goal is to do multiple 5Ks, a couple 10Ks building up to
when does training start for your first 5K?
So training in general starts, let's be honest, January 2nd. I'm not going to go out. I'm going to be eating a lot of food January 1st.
Sure. Recovering from December 31st.
Well, yeah. I can't tell you the last time I stayed up and watched the ball drop. I just like waking up. I just like eating food on New Year's Day. Yeah, so I'll have food in my stomach. And I'm not going to have the energy.
But, sauerkraut and sausage?
Oh, yeah. I love pork and sauerkraut.
So German.
Yeah, it's so good. Probably the second. I've already got a pair of shoes.
For those of you who don't live in areas with German ancestry, that's something that Germans do, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
I learned about that when I moved to Northeast Ohio.
It's gross.
Yeah.
You're not a sauerkraut guy?
Oh, I hate sauerkraut.
I love sauerkraut.
I love sauerkraut.
I like cabbage.
Sauerkraut is like an ingredient on a burger or hot dog. It is not...
I got you.
You eat it with pork.
But so, it's like a pile of sauerkraut.
I'm not authentically German. I do have a little German heritage. And, but my parents, like, I don't raise. So, like, we do crock pot, porks. We put shredded pork, sauerkraut, and then I either put it over rice or mashed potatoes.
I can do it with potatoes.
Then I put, like, sour cream or a crema on top
with
of it.
Potatoes.
So, I add stuff to it. I can't just do the acid in the pork to
it.
I have to add stuff to it.
Yeah.
But I do enjoy it. It does, I mean, but kraut does go well on a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I consider it more of a condiment. To me, it'd be like, would you like a bowl of mustard?
So, that's my only resolution / goal. So, to keep me accountable, because I am...
Look forward to checking in with you.
I'm dreading this as well as eager to do it.
Yeah.
You know, having a child now and stuff, like, I do want to be more conscious about my health. And I'm a goal-oriented person. If I don't have something that I can work towards,
right,
then I don't feel the need to work on something.
Yeah.
So for me, like, I can't just train for 10 months for one race in October. That's why I have to do the other races throughout the year.
Sure.
Because, like, I constantly have to have something that I can be working towards.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So ask me about it. I would love to be accountable with it and stuff. And I've been wanting to do this for a while and stuff. So I start that It's still December as we're recording this, but like I start that here in a couple weeks after the holidays.
Nice.
So I'm very excited. Connor, do you have any resolutions?
So, like Jeff, I don't like resolutions. Mm-hmm. Just the idea of them. When you put a hard date on starting something, you're more likely to fail.
Yeah.
You just need to do it. If it's something you want to do, you just go for it. But that being said, this is going to sound kind of sad. But my only real goal for 2024 is to get to Christmas of next year and not be single.
Oh.
That's my main goal. So, for all of you single ladies out there.
Oh, you just cut out half of our audience. Only ladies?
If you enjoy the sultry tones of my voice.
Yeah. I got to say, when it comes time to edit an episode, one of our best guests to have is Connor. It's just so smooth and silky.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, that's my only real goal for this year.
Well, I hope the best for that venture.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I never.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't. I always get uncomfortable when dating comes up because like I never dated in high school. Like I've never dated.
Yeah.
Lindsay was my first.
You hit her over the head with a sledgehammer.
Yeah. Just clubbed her. I don't know how to encourage someone because like I'm all for couples thriving and finding someone that you can spend life. I'm all for it, but just like I don't. I hated like that when I was a youth leader. I hated talking about it because like I don't have advice. I just feel like it luckily happened.
Yeah.
Because like I hope the best for you, man. That'd be awesome.
I've been in the Army for 5 years and I've been on multiple dates with different women over those 5 years.
From military?
Okay,
in and out. Okay.
Some no. And none of it has worked out. So
yeah. Maybe you're still sticking with women though.
Yeah, that's kind of a non-starter. It has to be.
What about women in quotation marks?
You know, I prefer the biological kind.
All right.
I get that. Nels?
Yeah. So when I had first asked you guys to be prepared for this, it's because I had a joke answer, but your guys' answers were so authentic. I feel like I owe you.
You can give us both.
I'll give you both.
And we'll guess which one's the joke one.
So on careful reflection, I've decided that over the next year, I will be even more radical. I've thought carefully about it, and I'm just going to double down.
Okay, what's the joke one?
It's just too easy of a goal for me, though.
Are you saying radical, like anarcho-capitalist radical? Because in my head, I'm picturing you in your Big Lebowski cardigan, hanging 10 on a like a longboard.
Radical! Yeah.
Out in the Pacific
somewhere.
Maybe
that should be my goal, is to be more... like 80s sense of radical. As far as like an actual legitimate
totally,
goal,
dude.
I need to be making healthier choices when it comes to what I consume diet wise. I've kind of let myself go in some regards there. So I don't have hard and fast deadlines and goals for that, but that is something that I need to make priority for myself in 2024.
I can get behind that.
Yeah.
You look great though. No.
I
love looking at you.
I look like a, I know what I look like.
Well, I wish you the best of luck in your quest to become more radicalized.
Thank you. Thank you. I've got a long list of books to be read this year that are going to be challenging and insightful.
Nelson, put down the cupcake. Let's just get back to it.
You're right. I don't need that.
Put it down. No, but don't... Nelson, stop. All right. Well, hey. Welcome. That's it for the show today. I say that joke every episode. No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
Let's get into some facts about this movie here.
Okay.
2007. Mm-hmm. This movie's about 2 hours and 2 minutes, depending on, if you cut it off before the credits. This is, for you, for the podcast, our second Coen Brothers film.
Yeah.
The Ethan and Joel Coen.
That's right.
I've got their list up. Just
one of my favorite directorial duos.
So we recently, not too long ago, did Fargo.
That's right.
A
movie you loved.
That's one of the ones where I'm like, I didn't enjoy it, but I can understand why.
Right.
Like,
why other people do.
Why other people do. It just didn't check out with me. Like, it just.
Yeah.
But spoiler alert, I loved this film.
Yeah.
So I'm not anti Coen Brothers. I found that out tonight.
Yeah.
And
of the three movies of theirs you've seen, They're all remarkably different.
They're drastically
they?
Different. Yeah. So
there is a through thread.
The other one I've seen is Oh Brother Where Art Thou.
Right. Yeah. There's a through thread of like ambition and and greed and stuff.
And but. I like some of the darkness. Like, and I couldn't tell you, if you go back to the Fargo episode, there were some things where like I had a hard time communicating because like I don't know what it was I didn't like.
Okay.
I liked the casting.
Yeah.
I thought they were dry as characters, but like it wasn't because they were bad actors.
No, no. In fact, they were acting very well in their dryness.
Like I liked the setting, but again, that was also still very white and plain. And like it's like, but I couldn't pin the nose on exactly why I didn't like the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even know if maybe it was the darkness of it.
Right.
But the darkness of this film, like just the kind of almost noir type. This wasn't so much a monologue-y, but like it had some of that, like just.
This had noir elements for sure.
Yeah, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
like so
they do great crime movies.
Yeah,
but
so
no two of their movies are stylistically like there's similarities, but I mean like there's not a whole lot of overlap with Fargo.
Every single one of their movies have a case of money, a briefcase of money.
I don't know if every single one of them, but a lot of them do.
I have a fun fact about that actually.
Let me add.
Briefcase of money in No Country for Old Men,
mm-hmm.
the exact same case they used for Fargo.
Is it?
It is.
I love that.
And not just like the same make and model. It's the same
case.
That makes me so happy. The skeptic in me would go, well, they probably had a couple on set.
Oh, I'm sure they had multiple.
But in general, I love the fact that is. Because like
the question you've asked.
The movie opens
I'm
up.
I'm trying to think, and I think almost every single one of them has a case of money in it. And the ones that I'm not sure about.
You haven't.
I would like flip a coin on whether or not there's a case of money.
Good reference there. I don't know if the Big Lebowski has a case of money.
I've never made it all the way through.
Really?
But like yeah. some other similarities.
I've tried like 3 times.
You look like you have.
I look like I am the Big Lebowski. I'm the bigger Lebowski. Look at me.
the movie opens up Spain and on a fence.
Yeah.
And then a little bit longer. Like just like there are just some like parallels. Obviously, movie doesn't take place in the Fargo universe, I don't think.
No, in fact, that's something I meant to look up. I'm going to look that up now.
But in general, there was, just because like Fargo's fresh in my head, I haven't seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou in a long time. But just, there are just right off the bat, I'm like, oh, this one's sort of a desert, but you got a fence. You've got like just it's just similarities, just different geographical locations. But very clearly, and Nelson, you texted this to me, Fargo has comedic elements. This movie did not.
No, there are punchlines in this.
Correct.
But this is like
of a comedy.
Fargo is a comedy. It's just an incredibly dry one. Yeah. This is not a comedy.
Correct.
Yeah.
This is very much a thriller with some tricky dialogue at times.
The Coen brothers do take a lot of inspiration from Cormac McCarthy, though.
Is that the author?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The author of this specific one.
Let's get into that question now then. So is this based on a book? Is this movie based on a novel or some sort of
literature? Hold on. One thing real quick.
Sorry. Nelson had to stop to eat a cupcake.
Okay. Well, actually, Stephen Root is in both.
The actor?
The actor, Stephen Root. So he was... And almost everybody else in this is shared is not on screen. So he's the only one that was an actor in both.
He was the businessman or the...
That's right.
High up in the...
That's right. Stephen Root is... He kills me, man. So let's see. What did they do in Fargo? And is it possible it's the same character? Actually, no. He's dead. And it's earlier. And it couldn't be the same guy because he died. His twin brother. Plot hole solved.
Yeah. Nailed it. That's what we should have done. Starting this podcast, we should have, you know how like there's the Pixar verse where like the theory that all Pixar movies take place in the same world or universe.
Mm-hmm.
We should have started this podcast with going every movie we watch, we have to somehow make it connect into the same world.
Well, almost all of these, many of the movies have fit into the Tommy Westphal universe.
Right. And you've mentioned that a couple times.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, so this movie's based on a book.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the author of this book, and do you guys have any facts about that? Or because I don't, I wasn't.
Yeah, so okay. It's Cormac McCarthy. He has a 2005 That's novel by the same name. Cormac McCarthy.
There you go.
Cormac McCarthy.
2005 novel by the same name. The only of his books that have been adapted to movies that I recognized, apart from this one, was The Road. I don't know if you remember that one. It was.
I've been on a couple.
The guy,
Viggo Mortensen.
Thank you. Except in this one, he doesn't kick a helmet and break his toe.
Lord of the Rings reference. I got it. Yeah. I understood.
I got you.
I'm sure like two of our listeners laughed at that.
Looking at you, Sheldon.
So, yeah, that was Cormac McCarthy, 2005 novel, also the same name, and it's linked below. And then there are some differences between the book and the movie. One key difference is that of focus. The novel belongs to Sheriff Bell. Each chapter begins with Bell's narration, which dovetails and counterpoints the action of the main story. Though the film opens with Bell speaking, much of what he says in the book is condensed and it turns up in other forms. Also, Bell has an entire backstory in the book that doesn't make it into the film. The result is a movie that is more simplified thematically, but one that gives more of the characters an opportunity to shine. Jay Ellis elaborates on Shakur's encounter with the man behind the counter at the gas station, where McCarthy gives us Shakur's question of, what's the most you ever saw lost on a coin toss? He says the film elides the more saw, but the Coens, of course, tend to the visual.
What?
Those are words I don't understand.
In the book, he says, what's the most you've ever seen lost in a coin flip?
Oh, okay.
Or a coin toss.
Right.
And they took out the word seen or saw or whatever it was, so that it was what's the most you've ever lost in a coin toss.
Okay. And then the name of the book and movie come from a William Butler Yeats poem. Sailing to Byzantium. There is no country for old men, the young. In one another's arms, birds in the trees, those dying generations at their song. The salmon falls, the mackerel crowded seas, fish, flesh, or fowl commend all summer long. Whatever is begotten, born, and dies, caught in that... In that sensual music, all neglect, monuments of unaging intellect. I don't know if that's really thought-provoking or if I'm stupid, but like that just feels like a word salad to me.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, do better, William Butler Yeats.
I have a book fact, if you'd like, I learned when I was doing a little bit of research here. So in the book, Sheriff Bell has a line when he's looking at all the dead cartel members right at the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, he says, here a while back in San Antonio, they shot and killed a federal judge.
Yeah.
That line is not in the movie, but the weird, crazy coincidence is that since the movie takes place in 1980, in the real world in 1979, there was a judge in San Antonio that was assassinated, Judge John Howland Wood.
Mm-hmm.
And he was assassinated by Charles Harrelson, who is Woody Harrelson's real-life father.
Really? Would that be Matthew McConaughey's father as well?
If you believe the conspiracy theory that they're brothers.
Which they seem to.
But yeah, he's in the movie.
Yep.
And there's a line from the book that links his father's
so weird
crime. So
that's wild.
I love that. Like,
I thought it was phenomenal how his death was so... Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Real quick, though.
Keep doing facts.
Well, I just want to say something about Fargo. What's his name? Stephen Root's connection. So he played a character in the first season of Fargo, the TV show, not the movie.
Oh.
He played a character named Bert Canton. He was in two episodes of the first season, and the first season takes place, I believe, a generation before the movie. Let me see if I can get the year.
You're really trying to connect this film to Fargo.
Oh, so it's 2006. It takes place later, I suppose. It takes place in 2006. So
it can't be.
Yes, unless it's his brother. Can't be. Yeah. It can't be. If unless it's his brother.
Mm-hmm. This movie came out in 2007.
Or it had to be his son because of age differences.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
Nelson, did you know this movie came out with one of your other favorite movies the same year?
Which one's that?
Into the Wild.
What one's that about?
I don't know.
I've heard of it.
Oh, yeah. So this movie came out the same year as Into the Wild.
John Kerouac.
It also came out the same year as There Will Be Blood, which I know you haven't done yet.
Right.
Yeah.
But that movie was filmed in the exact same location as No Country for Old Men at the same time that they were filming movie.
Yes.
Apparently there was...
Who directed that?
I don't know.
Apparently
there was a scene that the Coen brothers were trying to shoot,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden this big cloud of black smoke came across the road and they had to stop shooting and they went over the hill to see what was going on. And they were testing a bunch of pyrotechnic stuff for There Will Be Blood over the hill.
That's insane.
And it completely ruined their shot and they had to shoot the next day.
Paul Thomas Anderson.
I've never heard that name before. What's he done?
The Punch Drunk Love, Boogie Nights.
Oh, wow. Those are substantial movies.
The year before 2006, The Prestige came out.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two movies that we've already talked about previously that are in the same release year as this movie.
Interesting.
So we need to talk about some of the cast members. I'm not going to go through the roster of a lot of these cast members because a lot of them are pretty well known.
Yeah.
But they stop me if you recognize any of these. But Tommy Lee Jones, mm-hmm. he's in a lot. The one I don't know where I'm familiar with him, but Javier Bardem.
Yeah.
The murderer.
Yeah. I know
the name.
I went through like movies that he was known for and I really don't know him from anything.
He's in Skyfall, which is one of the Bond movies.
Yeah.
He's in Little Mermaid. He plays King Triton.
Yeah.
I've not seen the new Little Mermaid yet. He's in Pirates of the Caribbean. So like he's one like I don't remember him. So yeah. But he did great. I thought he was wonderful.
Phenomenal. Great villain.
Then we've got Josh Brolin, who, you know, he's in a lot of stuff. He was great.
Goonies, Thanos.
Yeah. And Deadpool. He's in two Marvel.
Yeah.
He's about to be canon twice in Marvel.
Yeah.
When Deadpool 3 comes out. Then you got Woody Harrelson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cheers.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly MacDonald. Now, I actually don't know where she's from.
Scotland.
Well, but like, I kept thinking she was the girl from Miss Congeniality. Not the lead one, but the one that goes, my perfect date is April 13th, whatever, like that. Yeah. Like, but it wasn't her. But I just, I kept seeing that character. But it's like, I couldn't place her, but I think I was just seeing her as someone else.
Yeah.
But she was great in this movie, but like, I'm not familiar with her outside the film.
She's in the last Harry Potter movie.
I did see that after watching the film. I did see, but like, again, I would not have known her from that.
And she also plays Nucky Thompson's wife in Boardwalk Empire on HBO.
I've not
seen that. With Steve Buscemi.
I've not seen
that. I think she's Irish in that.
I wish I had more to talk about with her, but. Okay.
Did you guys have any other notable cast members? I have one more that I got excited about when I didn't know he was in it until after the movie started playing.
Sure.
Garrett Dillahunt. He wasn't in it much.
Yeah.
I'm a Walking Dead fan. Mm-hmm. I've watched most of the episodes. They started releasing a lot in the past, and I haven't been able to catch up. But Garrett Dillahunt plays one of the characters in Fear the Walking Dead, and I really liked his character in that. That was my first introduction to him.
I kept thinking he was the guy from The Boys.
And then he's down this.
Is this the deputy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wait. Yeah. The
one that doesn't get strangled.
The assistant to Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I enjoy him as an actor and stuff, and it was fun seeing. He was a fun surprise. Yeah. That's all the cast that I recognize that's notable in this.
One other thing that there's really no point in the movie that we would discuss this otherwise, but I think it's fun for the. There's a super high death count in this movie. And according to List of Deaths fandom, this movie has 38 total deaths, 35 humans and 3 animals. Some of these are killed off screen or like before the movie starts and they're talked about. And so it gets a little bit more complicated than that. But Anton Chigurh kills 14 people in this movie.
Like we see him kill 14
people.
Who knows the backlog of
that
his character has.
But. And then the shoot-off off-screen, but like the drug deal gone bad that we opened up the movie with, there's 11 unnamed Mexican gang members that are dead there. That's what it says here listed. 11 unnamed Mexican gang members.
Yeah, that's very... I was curious about his kill count. I did not look that up. But before I get into the ratings, was the first viewing for either of you guys? It was my first viewing of this movie.
It was not my first viewing.
You'd seen it before?
I've seen this movie multiple times.
Okay.
I saw it in 2007, 2008, when it had come out.
Okay.
I haven't seen it since.
Okay, gotcha. Did you remember a lot from your...
I remembered specific moments. I was like that had really stuck out to me.
Okay.
For whatever reason, crossing the Rio Grande at night. Like, that scene was, like, burned into my memory.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember the first time you watched this movie, Connor? Like,
oh, it was years ago. It was probably close to when it first came out. Mm-hmm. And then I just rewatched it about 6 months ago before I watched it last night for this. Yeah. So
my first time was this morning. I watched it at 5 a.m. this morning. Thank you, snow delay. Or, yeah, snow, two-hour delay for the snowy weather we had. So you and Connor, you enjoy it. Nelson, did you like, do you like it after the second viewing? Did you like it after the first viewing? Like, what's your general opinion about the film? Just first glance, like, is this one that you think optimistically about, or like, what was your viewing experience?
I really liked it. I was looking forward to coming back to it. I generally like Coen Brothers movies quite a lot. This one is more similar in style to like Blood Simple. Some of them are more just like hard boiled. This is a crime movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I really enjoyed this one. I like that the three main characters are all super competent.
Yeah.
Like, that's just an interesting way to approach a crime movie.
I really enjoyed this movie. I struggled with the ending. We'll get into some spoilers here real quick, but like, and this is just me being probably ignorant and being 5 a.m. and I hadn't had my coffee yet. Moss, when they show Moss's character in the hotel dead, I didn't think it was him at first. Like, they're just sort of like, oh,
they killed him off screen.
Right. Like, there's Mexicans dead again. I was like, oh, that's a bummer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized, wait, was that? I didn't rewind and watch. I assumed that through the dialogue, it just kind of moved quickly past it and then just continued with Tommy Lee Jones's character. And then obviously, Anton going to go see the wife. Like, I just like, that felt abrupt.
Right.
So, like, if I had like,
which, and you were also expecting it to be a head fake of like, oh, actually this was a setup and,
right.
And maybe the sheriff's even in on it and all that stuff. But no, he's dead.
That's I wasn't necessarily mad at the fact that they killed him off. It was just the fact that I was like, wait, what? Like, the angle of like, I couldn't tell. Like, I didn't notice it was him mm-hmm. right away. And it wasn't until she got out of the car and was crying. I'm like, oh, do they think he's dead? And I'm like, oh, do I think he's dead? Like, oh, he is dead. Like, I had to come to the realization later.
I think maybe this should be held for a little bit later, but I think that ties into like one of the major themes of the movie is just like making death so insignificant.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you start off the movie with 11 dead guys.
And
I disagree.
Okay.
I think death is extremely significant in this movie. But going back to what you said, Jeff, I think the reason why he died off screen so unceremoniously is because he's not the main character of this movie.
No.
Tommy Lee Jones is the main character of this movie.
Yeah, right.
I agree with that. Yeah. And we'll dive into that a little deeper, but does he kill the wife? We don't know.
I think context clues, yes. So if you watch for like the whole movie, every time he kills somebody, he does not want to get blood on himself, right? Mm-hmm. He kills the one guy in the shower. He closes the shower curtain so that the blood doesn't get on him.
He puts his feet up on the bed.
The one guy, the blood's coming. He puts his feet up on the bed.
It's Woody Harrelson's character.
After he leaves the house and she refuses to call the coin or whatever, he leaves the house. There's that wide shot where he's on the front porch and he stops and he looks at the bottom of both of his boots to make sure there's no blood.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't pick up on that. Yeah. Okay. We'll get into the rest of that later. But yeah.
And he probably comes back later to kill that kid that he sold a shirt.
The ending was definitely the hardest part for me to digest. But even with that, overall, I really enjoyed this film.
Yeah.
And But I'll get to my review at the end of it and stuff. But yeah. 8.2 out of 10 on IMDb.
Mm-hmm.
Currently sits at 147 out of the top 250. Do you have the IMDb history, my man?
Nelson? Yeah. So it debuted November 9th at 235. And by December 22nd of that same year...
This is the release year of the movie?
Okay. Yeah. By December 22nd, it hit 14.
Oh, wow.
So it skyrocketed. And then it had a significant drop in 2013. But apart from that, it's just been kind of like slowly...
It's closed. Never been off the top 250.
No.
That's fascinating. Rotten Tomatoes, 93%.
Mm-hmm.
And... the audience, that's the tomato meter. Audience is 86%. I do not track this, so I could be wrong about this, but like, I feel like that's the biggest gap we've seen
between
tomato meter and audience so far.
Yeah. Who likes it more?
The critics.
Oh, okay.
The audience is 86. Like, Yeah, I feel like usually they're either both 80s, both 90s. Like, for there's only 7-point difference, but it just seems like a bigger gap than maybe what it is. Do you have the budget on this film, Nils?
Yes. One second. I was about to look up. I wanted to know if this is their highest rated. The Coen Brothers.
The Coen Brothers. Got you. Okay.
On Rotten Tomatoes. Looks like True Grit is his best with critics.
That's Clint Eastwood, right?
Yeah. No. The original remake. This one's with
Jeff Bridges.
Jeff Bridges, yeah.
And Haley Steinfeld.
True Grit, Blood Simple, Fargo, Miller's Crossing, No Country for Old Men. So that would be their fifth best according to the tomato meter. But if we go by audience score, it's Big Lebowski, Fargo, Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink, Oh Brother Art Thou, Blood Simple, Bridge of Spies, Down from the Mountain, No Country for Old Men. And then Raising Arizona. I might put Raising Arizona above it, but it's not the Coen Brothers' best movie, but it is a very good Coen Brothers movie. Mm. Down from the Mountain is a documentary that I'd never heard of.
Yeah. It is a Coen Brothers film.
Yeah.
So wait, so Jeff, the True Grit with Jeff Bridges, that's the original?
No,
that's the remake.
No, so okay, so the Coen Brothers did the remake.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm caught up now. Yeah, I was getting True Grit mixed up with Gran Turismo. Oh, Gran Torino with Clint Eastwood.
That's also excellent.
Because
Gran Turismo is also very good.
I've not seen Gran Turismo yet.
Is the original True Grit with Clint Eastwood?
Let me look.
Because I've not seen it. Yeah, the new Gran Turismo, it's got Detective Hopper in it, right?
It does.
Or Sheriff Hopper.
The ads for that movie made it look horrible.
Yeah,
I disagree. The ads made me want to see it. I'm not a racing movie guy, but like that. The trailers I was very excited for. I just didn't go
see it. I saw it in theaters. I thought it was very good.
John Wayne.
Oh, okay.
Not, yeah. John Wayne is in the original True Grit.
Yeah.
Budget.
Sorry, yes. No, $25 million to make in 2007. That would cost $37 million today.
Okay.
Just with inflation.
That feels about right.
Yeah.
Everything was practical. I did have a fact about...
You mean the budget feels right, not the inflation?
The budget feels right. No. Inflation always feels right. They used a lot of fake blood in this movie.
Yeah, I had to look away regularly. Couldn't handle it.
They had to get special fake blood for this movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell us more.
They did. They had to get blood shipped from England, and it cost like $800 a gallon.
Wow.
Because normal fake blood is made with corn syrup,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't use anything with sugar because the actors... Like all of the dead people were laying on the ground for so long out in the sun, they didn't want the bugs to attack them because of all the sugar in the fake blood. So they had to get a sugar-free blood substitute from England.
They're so woke.
That blood, I thought, looked really convincing.
Yeah.
What did you think? Did you think the blood looked convincing?
Yeah. I mean, on-screen blood never looks quite like real blood.
Yeah.
Blood is actually very, very bright red. Real blood.
Okay.
Until you get like a bunch of it that kind of soaks in, then you get a little bit of that darker color. And movies tend not to do that because people think that it's fake.
Right.
But really, if they wanted to be accurate, it would be bright red.
Until it starts to pool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Until it starts to coagulate?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah.
The one scene very early on where after he steals the cop car. He's driving off, and then he pulls the other guy over to steal that car. It was the one scene where he's using the what's the name of the device he uses?
It's
used to kill cattle, right?
I know this.
Ramrod.
I can't think of it.
When he does it to the forehead of the guy at the beginning, like that for me, like that set the tone. So that was the hardest casualty to watch. Captive
piston pistol or something like that.
That was hard to watch. But then it made the rest of the film easy.
I think the spots that I had to look away the most were the broken arm, the compound fracture. Oh,
with the bone was coming out?
That was hard for me.
Oh, that was horrible.
Also, when... who had the leg wound that was gushing blood? Was that Sugar?
It was a big psychopath.
Big
was,
open one. Yeah, that one was difficult for me. But then also... I don't know who it is that fires the shotgun, but they catch a guy's arm first, and the arm blows like backwards and crooked, and like Maybe I.
None of that bothered me.
Yeah. But, I mean, like you've seen real injuries.
Yeah.
I've seen like one or two serious injuries in my life. You've seen enough to become not desensitized, but comfortable, like maintain your composure in that situation.
The only thing that bothers me,
yeah,
as far as injuries are concerned, that I have to deal with are ocular injuries.
Eyeballs?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Anything with an eyeball freaks me out. And I think it's just the subconscious fear of losing my eyesight.
Mm.
So like when I see, especially penetrating trauma where there's something like sticking out of their eye,
yeah,
that freaks me out.
The most suspenseful scene in this movie was when he's in the hotel room, he's sitting at the end of the bed because he realized that he's in, the bad guy's in the hotel. And so he calls the phone down.
Sorry.
And the guy doesn't pick up. So he's sitting at the end of the bed and then the hall light turned off. That scene freaked me out. Like that was probably the most, like I was edge of my seat. So that was enjoyable as far as entertainment goes.
By the way, it's called a captive bolt gun.
Captive bolt gun.
Or bolt pistol.
And it's designed for humanely killing like cattle, right?
Yeah.
That's so the main use of that?
It doesn't necessarily always kill them, but it does stun them.
Okay.
The story that the one guy told, the sheriff tells, he tells the wife, when he makes the connection that's the tool being used, he talks about how they use a rifle to shoot a cow. And it was a glancing shot. My dad's told me this story a couple times when he was a kid and they had to put a cow down. And, like, it took a couple shots because they have such incredibly thick skulls. And if you're not getting it, like, right on the spot, they have really thick, really big skulls and really small brains. So usually when they're using these kinds of things, it is just to stun the animal. Honestly, that one of the most humane ways to kill an animal, if you can, is while they are calm, you cut its throat and both arterial arteries. Is that right? Arterial arteries?
Well, that's the same thing. Arterial means artery.
Oh. Man.
There's venous and arterial bleeding. Venous is your veins. Arterial is arteries.
Okay.
So you've got...
It's always good to have you around because I can remember like that I'm a absolute moron.
So like in your neck, you've got a jugular vein.
Okay, that's the one. The jugular
vein. And a carotid artery.
So you want to cut both those in the animal when you go to butcher them.
Arteries carry oxygenated blood to the cells.
Okay.
Veins carry deoxygenated blood back to the heart to get reoxygenated.
So, Nelson.
So, Jeff.
Peanut gallery. We mutually, this isn't just on you, because I could be better at keeping you accountable in the things that you have
it's
on
your fault for not reminding me, Jeff.
But we, what happened with the peanut gallery this week?
Well, typically, the Friday before we record, I put out a survey to hear from our Patreon subscribers, and I straight up plain forgot. So we do not have feedback from our peanut gallery. However, we do have with us somebody who often answers those polls, so
yes,
we can just ask him in person. Connor, would this movie be in your personal top 250?
I think it probably would.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I enjoy this movie quite a bit.
There you go. So that is the consensus opinion of our Patreon subscribers that have answered the poll so far.
Yeah. Works for me.
Yeah.
Actually, I desubscribed this morning.
No.
We're going to have to ask you to leave. I have grace for you, Nelson, because I have also missed some posts in our social media throughout the season. So
maybe that's what we should should be our New Year's resolution, is to be more consistent with our social media.
Be more on schedule, yeah. All right, gentlemen, we've made it to the nuts and bolts of this film.
Yeah.
We've made it through all the light stuff, which we've hit on some stuff. So what do you guys got? What are some biases? What's some stuff we need to discuss?
There's one early on that I am curious as to the accuracy of. You know, he's a sheriff that doesn't carry his gun. His dad didn't, and his grandfather didn't. Now, the accuracy of that is, like, entirely subjective. This is a fictional character. But at what rate do sheriffs not carry guns? I'd be surprised if there's very many.
I don't know. Yeah. My grandfather was a sheriff, and he carried a gun.
Yeah. So 100% of sheriffs polled...
Grandsons of sheriffs pulled.
Yeah. But Andy Griffith did not.
That's true.
He, You're right. But no, Barney
he even says in one of the episodes he doesn't carry a gun because he wants people to respect him as a man, not fear him right. as a cop.
And Don Knotts does though.
Yeah, because he shoots himself in the foot at one point.
Yeah.
Or does he not also carry, and then he shoots himself in the foot because he's not from? I forget how that episode plays out.
Point is, at some point, Don Knotts shoots himself in the foot.
Andy Griffith, it's a great
literally show. And figuratively.
Yeah, that line actually didn't strike me just because it sounded so like. Yeah, I didn't catch that, but yeah, that is hard to believe. Like, and I can't imagine that there's sheriffs walking around now without being armed.
Right.
With that, at least like maybe the taser, or like they have some sort of debilitating.
Right. I mean, like, it's just my position that most people should.
Right.
And the more enabled you are to do that, the more likely I think you are to take advantage of that. So it just seems odd to me that a sheriff wouldn't.
But yeah. As the movie goes on with his character development, he does carry a gun toward the end.
That's right.
Yeah. Because he has one with him when he goes into the hotel room at the end.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because he's expecting.
Well, and he also, the more he interacts through the story, he's also realizing the elevated skill of the assassin.
Yeah.
Like, he's realizing, like, this isn't just some mamsy-pamsy guy. Like, this guy knows how to evade. This guy knows how to track down, like.
And he doesn't leave a trace so much that it's almost like he's not even there.
That's yeah. because he's not.
You're
setting me up for that.
I teed Connor up for that one.
I don't believe Anton Chigurh is a real person.
Wait, what?
That's what he was saying. And he doesn't just mean in the sense of this is a fictional movie. He means that even within the movie, he doesn't believe
that he's. So he's like Brad Pitting us in Fight Club.
Well,
no,
I'd like to hear the theory, but I have an objection.
Was there any more on your gun?
No. Actually, audience, I don't want to cut you off. If you are a sheriff, have family or friends that were sheriffs, and they didn't or did carry, and like if you know definitively one way or the other, I'd like to know. I'm curious. Is it common for sheriffs in America to not carry? I would be surprised.
Okay. I'm very curious. I did not think about this at all.
So I understand that there are characters that interact with him throughout the movie, mm-hmm. right?
Dialogue.
The two other main characters never do. They never share the screen together. Now, there is the shootout that they have that Llewellyn and Anton Chigurh have in the street. But when they're shooting, one's always ducking. One's looking up. They're running around corners. They never actually see each other. Okay? So in my opinion, Anton Chigurh is just a physical embodiment of the chaos and the rules that the world and society follow. If that kind of makes any sort of sense at all.
You lost me at the last bit there.
So, first of all, I have a whole note about this. So, I don't think Anton is real. He's a boogeyman. He gets out of situations that are improbable to escape, like killing the guy in his office on the whatever floor he was on, getting out of the building completely unscathed.
Right.
Even the part where Sheriff Bell goes to the motel room and he sees that the lock has been blown out. When he pulls out his gun, it kind of zooms in on that lock and you see the reflection of his head, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wait, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, that's when he goes to the crime scene of Llewellyn.
Yeah,
he's looking through the blown out lock, and the reflection you see Anton Chigurh, and then they actually cut to the room, and it's Anton Chigurh also looking at him.
Okay.
And then the door, he pushes the door open, holding the gun, and Anton Chigurh is not in there. I read that scene as this is what Tommy Lee Jones is internally thinking is happening. But not what's like.
You're seeing what Tommy Lee Jones is seeing, not necessarily what's happening.
What he's feeling, yeah. Not what he's seeing.
Possibly. You know what I mean? But here's how I saw it, okay? So he sees the reflection of his head in the lock hole, right?
Mm-hmm.
That to me represents the heads on a coin.
Okay.
Okay. And he's essentially, it's like an allegory for a coin flip. He's looking at it and determining whether or not he's going to open the door.
Right.
He doesn't know if he's on the other side of that door or not.
Right.
So it's a coin flip if he opens the door and nobody's there, if he opens the door and he gets shot right away. So I thought that was just good visual storytelling as far as you see his head. I just think he represents the rules of chaos that the world runs on.
Okay.
And I think that the wife at the end, mm-hmm. her comments kind of confirm this. When he goes to flip the coin, he says, call it. And she says, the coin don't have no say. It's just you. It's kind of saying the decisions that we make, while they affect our lives in the short term, the world and as a whole and society, the rules that we all have to follow kind of affect the way that our lives go in the long term.
Okay.
And then toward the end of the movie, I know we're skipping ahead here, but the car accident that he gets in.
That was going to be my question for you, yeah.
So I think that is just a visual representation of the idea that the world and the rules that we follow are subject to time and place and chance. He gets into the car accident, and then he pays the kid for a shirt, right? I think the overarching theme of the entire movie is death and greed.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is like every Coen Brothers movie.
Right. Yeah. But I think that that is shown when he gives the kid money for his shirt. And then as he's walking away, the two kids are fighting right. over yeah. who gets the money.
Right.
And then he gets away scot-free.
Yeah.
And then Sheriff Bell never goes after him again.
Right.
I don't think he's a real person. I think he's kind of an internalization of the chaos of the world that Tommy Lee Jones's character is trying to wrestle with.
Mm-hmm.
As far as he wishes the world was the way that it was when he was younger.
And the way he remembers it.
Well, yeah, right. When he was younger and he was looking up to all these old men.
Mm-hmm.
And he has this nostalgia for the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he realizes as the movie goes on that he can't save everybody.
Right.
But he can do the best that he can.
Well, in the conversation he has with his, I think that's his uncle, where they're talking about how
the gentleman in the wheelchair.
Yeah. And they're talking about other sheriffs of the area and how they died. And it was like just random, seemingly random violence.
Mm-hmm.
I give you that he represents like a specter of the violence that was the wake of the Mexican drug cartels in Texas.
I think he just represents chaos.
And yeah, well, I can give you both those. Where I get hung up on it is the car accident and the kids, but then also later the, much earlier, the gas station attendant.
The whole conversation that's had with the guy that's at the...
Who doesn't die.
Right. So my only question would be like, because like, I'm all for interpretive, like, artistical representations of emotions and stuff, but like, we see immediate implications of things that happen because of the character of Sugar. So how do you explain all the events that happen if it's not actually him? Is it different people that are causing these things that we're just seeing represented in one guy?
So that's what
I thought you were saying.
My interpretation is that Llewellyn takes the money. The cartel is now after him.
Mm-hmm.
He is running from the cartel while Sheriff Bell is trying to catch up to all of them, right?
Right.
Anton Chigurh is kind of the representation of that whole scenario plus the chaos of the world around them all together. And I think with the scene, which my favorite scene in the movie where he's talking to the convenience store guy and he does the coin flip, even that could just be a representation of the way that chaos sometimes works in our favor.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that he's not a real character in the movie. I'm just saying that I think as far as the two main other characters,
mm-hmm.
that they're really the ones that the story is focusing on. And he is just an agent of chaos to explain everything that's going on around them.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's not as believable like in Fight Club where like they show all the things how like Brad Pitt's character didn't interact with anyone. It is believable in the sense like what Anton represented, whether he was real or figurative, it does make sense. Like he is chaos, whether he was real or whether it was a culmination of different things. It makes sense in what he represents versus like, was it just actually him? Like part of me wants it to really be him though. Cause like I, for some reason, I just liked him. Like, Like, and I get, I'm not for murder. Obviously, I don't even need to say that. But like,
that seems inconsistent, like, with every time you've rooted for it in the past, though.
But like,
you were cheering him on the whole time. Just
he was such an intriguing character that I'm just like, I want to dive deeper into him. Like, okay, so Mindhunters, that Netflix series, where the guy goes around and interviews serial killers that are. I'm interested in getting in the mind of people that do corrupt things. It's like, I was just so fascinated with him. I was like, I don't want a story to end, because like, I just want to know more. I just want to see him do more things and try to learn more about him. So I was rooting for him in a sense that like,
he's a fascinating character.
I wanted to learn more about him. Right. I wanted his story to continue so I could get a bigger picture.
Yeah.
But in the same time, I'm like, you're a dirtbag. Like, you're such a bad guy. You're so naughty. Like,
so then, all right. Anton Chigurh. Leaning into the he's not real. Woody Harrelson's character seems to think he's real.
Does he? I mean, he kills him. And when he's talking to Llewellyn, he's telling him what his motivations are and that he's going after his wife.
Yeah.
But he tells him that he doesn't have any motivation. Right? That he just, that's the way that he operates. He's not motivated by money. He's not motivated by...
Yeah.
Lust. He's not motivated by all this stuff.
He seemed to be pretty motivated by this $2 million, though.
It was an objective.
Yeah, but like, he wasn't recovering it for the syndicate, because he killed the two syndicate guys, and they sent Woody Harrelson to kill him because of that. Speaking of that $2 million, that's $7.45 million today. And there's that line, at what point would you quit bothering to look for your $2 million? That's what he says to his wife as he's trying to get her out the door. And that was a question that I paused and sat with for a second.
I was going to ask you two, if you are Llewellyn in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah. What do you do?
Do you take the money?
Let's go Jeff first. What do? You find 11 dead Mexican cartel guys, a couple trucks full of heroin.
You know they're there illegally.
Or cocaine.
Yeah. I do not have the backbone to go to justify taking the money and running.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I get the setting of the movie is it's no man's land. Like it's sort of an outlaw territory. Like you, people get away with stuff, and like the setting that they've established, like things go unnoticed in some cases. But like, I'm not speaking as if I was Llewellyn. I'm speaking if it was Jeff that came across this. Like, I couldn't do it. I'd immediately be calling 911. I probably would have wet myself too, seeing all that crap. Like I would have gotten the heck out of there. I'm an optimist, except for like when things are already bad in that situation. Like he walked upon a bad situation.
Oh yeah.
Like, so my mind would not. I have a hard time being optimist in when situations are already dim. And so for me, I'm like, I would be thinking of all the ways every action I'd be taking would go wrong. And stealing the money, or finders keepers, whatever you would call, my mind would be going, this is not going to end well. I couldn't. And that's not just me being altruistic. Like, I really feel like, here's a story. And this is a vivid memory of mine. And I was in church as a child growing up. We were sitting in the balcony watching this sitting in service one time. I opened up a hymnal. And I found a $20 bill.
It's a hernal these days.
Hernal? A him, they, neural. And I found a $20 bill.
Yeah.
Why there was a $20 bill in the hymnal, I have no idea.
Right.
But my parents were sitting next to me, and they didn't see me find it. But I couldn't, even in my adolescent child consciousness, just pocket it.
Right.
I put it in the offering plate. That was without my parents. And this is not me. I'm not tooting my own horn. This is just showing me, like, I don't know if it was out of, like, you know, almost like Edgar Allan Poe, like, they'll find me out somehow. Someone will know that I stole money from offering or whatever. Like, I don't know. Like, but just, like, I can't. I have a hard time doing that. And if I do something, I'll end up talking about it to someone, and it'll just eat me alive. Like, it's like, I definitely would not have taken the money. I would have called someone. Honestly, at the first sight of blood, I probably would have ran. I wouldn't have even investigated any longer. I probably would never have even found the money. I would have seen the dead dog and be like, yeah, I'm out of here. Yeah, No. So
I would have probably chased the limping dog instead of turned gone the other direction to see what's he running from.
So to answer your question, no, I would not have kept the money. I would never have made it to the point of finding the money. But at that point, when the dog came across, my mentality was the same thing. Like, well, follow the dog, make sure the dog's okay.
Yeah, thinking like, where's that dog coming from?
But Josh Brolin's character is he's a very smart character, and he knows the dog's going from something.
Yeah, let's go see
what. I want to go where he's. It's like, and I'm like, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah,
I'm like, where's this going? What's this dog have to do with it? Like, so just like, I loved the story. Like, I loved how they build the characterization of Josh Brolin's character without even dialogue.
Right.
Just a hunting.
Right from the beginning, like when he picks up the shell.
It was incredible. It was like, to answer your question, no, I wouldn't have made it to the money, and I would not have, I couldn't have done it.
To answer it for myself. No. So let's strip away all of the things that led up to finding the money. It's just that, what would you do if you found the money? So I'm going to tell two stories of myself. The first one, my dad and I were heading somewhere, and we were in a town that we didn't know, and I saw a wallet on the ground on the sidewalk right by our car. I picked it up, and then I made my dad, because I couldn't drive yet, and he was driving. We drove around just kind of like in circles until we found a police car. Then we pulled behind the police car and left our turn signal on, and just followed them for a while until they put on their lights and pulled over, and we pulled over, and he came up and he's like, can I help you?
Is that even legal now? Like, can you pull a cop? Like they'd probably be super suspicious.
Technically, legally, you can arrest police officers as a civilian.
Citizen's arrest. Another good luck trying. Andy Griffith reference. Citizen's arrest. There's an episode about that.
I've not watched much Andy Griffith. Gotcha. Anyway, so we pulled him over, and the officer's like, is there still money in the wallet? And I was like, well, that's a good question. I don't know. And we looked, and there was like a couple $100 in cash and a driver's license. And he's like, all right, I'll turn this in, and hopefully we can find the guy. That same summer, I walked to the grocery store by myself, used a self-checkout lane, and I bought something in cash. It was like, you know, I put a $10 bill in, and it was like $3, and it gave me like $80. And I walked out with that $80. And then later that same week, I lost my wallet, and then I got a call from the library that my wallet had been found and there was no money in it. And I remember being like, man, that sucks, but also like, it's not my money. I shouldn't have had it in the first place. Yeah. And it was just a weird moment for me emotionally. So to answer your question of would I have kept the money, I think the precedent is really, this is a little on the nose, but a bit of a coin toss, because like two times where I've had an opportunity to walk away with found money, and like one time I didn't, one time I did.
Yeah.
Now, as far as like, what would I do if I stumbled on a location that has been shot up with 11 dead Mexican drug cartel and a bunch of cocaine? I would leave. I would leave immediately.
Yeah. Before I ask you the same question, Connor, I do want to say, like, the amount of money is also adds weight to the situation.
$7.45 million.
If I was in the middle of the desert and I stumbled upon a $100 bill, yeah, I'd pocket it.
Next like, to a dead guy?
Well, okay, no. That would change things. Like, if there's a dead guy, I ain't putting my fingerprints on anything.
Oh, sure. Like, if there's nobody there and I stumbled upon like a chest with gold in it, that's my gold now. I have found this gold.
Yeah. So I think the fact that like it was $2 million, like it's a traceable amount.
Actually, I'm gonna,
like, I would be like, okay, like serial numbers, like each dollar bill, true. But if it was just one bill, $100 bill, I'd be like, that's mine. I'll spend that so quickly, it won't even be in my pocket for long. Like, it's just the fact that $2 million is such a big number. I would be scared that
someone
knows it's missing. Hundred.
But then again, like if I found $2 million of gold coins while I'm out for a hike. It's harder to trace, though.
Now, if you dug it up, like if it had been there for years, but if you come upon a fresh crime scene and there's
cash, there's
a lot of different variables.
Yeah, so actually,
I'm not altruistic. I'm not saying I would make the moral issue decision every time.
Well, I would say the found money thing, the two examples I gave are different from what we're talking about here, because one, that's a wallet that I turned in, and so, like, we know who this belongs to. And the other one, like, very clearly it belonged to the grocery store that the machine spat out the too much. So I guess both the examples I gave were different in context. In the context of, like, the person that this money belongs to is dead, and they're not going to... I don't know, that's weird morality, man. Mm-hmm. It is a little different. Mm-hmm. If I find gold coins, though, I'm definitely taking them. End of story.
Are there different laws for, like, treasure hunting? Like, I guess it depends on the property it's on, right?
It also has to do with, like, are there surviving claimants and stuff like that.
I've always wanted to get a metal detector and go find
treasure. Be a metal detectorist?
Yeah, just detect metal.
There's a really great TV show called...
Expedition Unknown.
The Metal Detectorists, I think.
Wait, that's an actual show?
I think so.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, they make a punchline early, and it's like, because they're like, well, we're not metal detectors. These are. We're metal detectorists.
It's a British show. I'm oddly into it. I would watch it. It's very good.
I recommend it.
Expedition Unknown.
Yeah, Expedition Unknown. Josh Gates is wonderful. I enjoy his series on it. It's HBO. He's on HBO Max now, but it's Discovery Channel.
Discovery Channel. So, what about he's you, wonderful. Connor?
So
let's give the most stripped down version of, like, we don't know who it belongs to. There's just you stumble on.
Let me preface this. So if it is somebody,
if I did,
I can neither confirm nor deny.
But if I did, I might have behaved like this.
No, if I know, like, whose money it is, or even if, like, I see somebody drop money, I'm not taking it. I'm giving it back. Right. Like, just last week, I was at a Cold Stone Creamery.
Ooh, nice.
And I'm sitting there eating some ice cream with some friends. And the guy at the counter, he pays, he goes to leave, and he missed his pocket, didn't notice. His wallet falls on the floor, and he goes out the door. Mm. I was the only one that saw that happen. I see his wallet on the ground. I run over, I pick it up, I chased him out of the Cold Stone. He was getting in his car. I probably look like a psychopath. So I'm going, he pulls out his gun. Hey, guy, dude.
Hey, and, hey, they, them, he, her,
like Tucker and Dale's like, we got your friend.
I love that movie. But I gave him his wallet back and he was appreciative of that and everything. Like, if I see somebody drop money in front of me and it's, you know, it's not mine, I'm going to pick it up and hand it back to them. That being said, if I stumble upon 11 dead cartel members and I see $2 million sitting under a tree.
Well, you probably use so much of that cocaine that you'll never find that $2 million.
I have never done cocaine in my life, but sir.
You wouldn't in that opportunity?
No.
Like, just a little curiosity?
No.
Just pick up a package and lick it.
I would honestly, I'd probably take the money.
It's hard not to.
If I know for sure that what they're doing is illegal, and that money is probably profit from them selling all these drugs.
And kids.
I'm probably taking that money. Now I'm also probably going through that briefcase as soon as I get home.
Right.
And I'm going to find that tracker.
Yeah.
And I'm also probably not going back to give a guy water.
Yeah.
So.
Probably going to dump it out on your bed and count it and tell your wife and be like, holy crap.
Yeah. And then
I thought their interactions were hilarious, where, like, he tells her it's a briefcase full of money. She's like, that'd be nice.
Yeah. I'm probably hiding most of it and then trying to figure out the closest casino to go launder some of it.
Yeah.
Casinos is a great way of laundering money.
I want to
take the moral high ground, but I'm saying
with the current climate we're in right now,
and the way that inflation is and how hard just buying Christmas presents has hit my wallet, I'm probably taking that money.
Even if you don't take the whole briefcase, you're
just taking
I'm at least pocketing some stacks. Yeah.
It's similar, like, if you find, like, a thing of gold coins, there's no way you're not taking one. Because if you're never going to spend that gold coin, it's like, let me tell you the story about how I found this gold coin. Right.
Money can't buy happiness, but it sure can buy peace of mind.
Yeah. And the things that make you happy.
To bounce off
more cupcakes.
Yeah. to bounce off that, like, when he goes back with the water, do you think that was strictly?
I don't think he was originally planning to.
Okay.
That's why he got up in the middle of the night to go do it.
So when he did it, though, like, do you think his motives were pure at that point? Or like, did you like, was just like, what was going through his head? Because like, it's a dangerous place. Like, and he now has the money. He now has a gun. And now he's going back to show his face again. For his, like, he's like,
he feels, I think he feels guilty for having walked away from a dying man without helping. And the only consolation he gave the guy was, ain't no Lobos. That's Spanish for wolves.
We know.
I would not,
have known that if I didn't tell you. I know.
What is his profession? What is Josh Brolin's character's profession?
He's a retired welder.
Retired welder.
And previously fought in Nam.
Okay.
And now mustache model.
Yeah. And care of the 6 Infinity Stones. At some point.
6 of them?
Yeah, there's 6.
I just don't know why he needed that $2 million. He already got One-Eyed Willie's treasure.
That's true.
Oh, yeah. Goonies.
Times are tough.
The Goonies. That's a great movie.
Never seen it. This year.
January 1st. I've not watched it yet.
I watched it last week.
Did you really?
Yeah.
It's been a minute since I've seen it. It's a great movie. Ki-Hoo Kwan is making a comeback too.
Yeah, he is, and I'm so glad.
He's in an animated movie too that's getting ready to come out too. Like
I think he's pretty animated in most of the movies.
He's great.
He's in
Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Well, he's in Loki.
Loki, yep.
Which
he's
needs a new Kang.
Loki was, yeah.
There's a line never that I thought it. Was really, I've heard of it.
You'd like it.
you would like it. I like this line a lot. It says, true story? Well, I couldn't swear at every detail, but it is true that it's a story. I really like that line. He's a super, super dry comic relief in the movie. I think he has more punchlines than just about anybody else. One of those jokes that I really like, because you got the old, a different old sheriff complaining about the way culture's gone. He said, if you'd have told me 20 years ago that I'd be seeing kids walk in Texas towns with green hair and bones in their noses, I wouldn't have believed you. And then, what's his name? Sheriff Bell. Sheriff Bell responds, well, once you stop hearing sir and ma'am, the rest is soon to follow. And I feel like in that line, he's kind of somewhat mocking the other sheriff. Or did you think that read more genuine?
I think it's more genuine.
Okay. Do you think it's true?
That's a more difficult question.
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't even know how to answer that.
What about you, Jeff? Do you think it's true?
I don't know my answers, but like, I recently have experienced something like this where it's uncomfortable. It's like, I don't know if this correlates, but I'm going to share a story. So I'm subbing in 2 different schools. I'll try to be as anonymous as possible, but one school does the Mr. in last name or Mrs. in last name, Mrs. whatever. The other school chooses to go more informal, and it's by first name.
So you're Mr. Jeff? Or just Jeff?
Just Jeff.
I don't know if I like that.
It doesn't me think of the kids less. Like for me, like the status of the kids for me, like the way I see them and the way I hold their value, it stays the same no matter how they view me.
Which one's the public?
Public is Mr. Reddick.
Interesting. Okay.
The private school that I work at is
Jeff.
Jeff. Which, and it's uncomfortable, not because like I strongly disagree with it, but just with the fact like it's just weird. Like I'm in a position of
authority,
and it does feel wrong for it to have that equally, but to be the complete antithesis of what I'm just saying, like at the same time, like I do get that idea of trying to be on their level,
you spin the chair backwards, you sit down, like, let's rap.
Yeah, like put my hair, put my cap on back, like I get when you're in a status, when you're in a position that specifically is meant to lead.
Okay.
It's not in a coworker status. It is in a, I am someone above you in some sort of way to guide you in a specific direction to do a specific thing.
Yeah.
It feels more normal for there to be some sort of established reverence.
Okay.
Or some sort of, I don't know if reverence is the right word, but some sort of established I don't even want to use hierarchy, but just acknowledging, like, yes, like, it feels weird saying that.
Let me ask you,
it is uncomfortable.
I know, you've not worked in medicine ever, right?
I had a bloody nose once.
Okay. Would you expect, actually, Connor, you might actually have more input on this, but I want to get your intuition on this first.
Yeah.
And I'll give you mine as well, and then Connor can tell us. Would you expect in a hospital or medical situation that those with the title of doctor be referred to as Dr. So-and-so rather than by their first name, even though they're coworker, because they're coworkers? You know what I mean? What would you expect there? I would expect that any doctor insisting on being called Dr. So-and-so, that people would think that that's kind of ugly behavior.
Yeah.
But also I can see just as likely a doctor, like let's say that the hospital requires that you refer to him as Dr. Dorian,
right,
and all the nurses call him JD instead, and maybe they get in trouble
for that.
I
like your reference.
Yeah. Connor, insights?
As far as my experience working in a medical facility?
Yeah.
So mine's a little different because I'm in the military,
sure,
and all of the doctors.
Sergeant Doctor.
All of the doctors are officers.
Officer doctor.
Officer doctor.
So we call them by their rank.
Yeah.
Normally.
Rank doctor.
So like the two doctors that I work with are, one's a captain and one's a major. So we'll call them.
Are either of them doctors?
Yes, they're both doctors.
So how do you refer to them as?
Do you ever call them?
Sometimes if I'm like with a patient, I'll say Major Mitchell, and sometimes I'll say Dr. Mitchell.
Okay, so you don't say Major Mitchell, Major Dr. Mitchell.
No.
You just say,
ridiculous.
Okay.
But I would love it. Can you start?
I'd be here for it, yeah.
Major Dr. Mitchell.
But like if we're just referring to them, like we're typing something up on the computer or whatever, and we're like, which doctor or which provider saw this person, sometimes we'll just use their last names.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Would it be weird if say there's no client not patient. Sorry.
Same thing.
I do too much sales. Say there's no patient, right? And it's just you and Major Dr. Mitchell having a conversation. Do you just call him by his first name?
No, I usually call him sir.
Okay. And that's because he outranks you?
Yes.
So like he wouldn't call you sir in any situation?
No, but they do generally use my rank when referring to me.
Okay.
It's
all very silly.
It's a little weird. My opinion, though, like,
yeah, it gives very specific organizational structure and framework for interaction.
It does.
Yeah.
And calling people sir and ma'am is just kind of a sign of respect.
Yeah.
Like even when you're in the military in basic training, they teach you whenever you're speaking to a civilian to call them sir or ma'am.
Yeah.
Depending on who you're talking to, just as a sign of respect.
Yeah, I do it with I use sir with police because it makes those interactions simpler, and typically anybody that I think is older than me.
Yeah, I'm never going to be the guy that goes, "That's Mr. Riddick, that's Dr. Riddick." Like I can't say that.
I do. I have told people actually it's Dr. Nelson.
But like, so like in the same time, like where I'm not going to correct someone and go, "Call me by this."
Yeah,
like even in a school setting,
Would you be so bold?
It feels weird.
Would you ever correct somebody? Like, so obviously mispronouncing your name's one thing.
Right.
But let's say that you didn't like Jeff. You preferred Jeffrey. Would you correct people like, actually, it's Jeffrey?
No. I've never done that.
If people call me Nelly, I do say I don't care for that.
How do you feel about Nels?
That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, Nels, those are both fine. But Nelly... there are a handful of people I'll permit that with.
Down, baby. Oh, shoot. Sorry.
My job's just different.
Yeah.
Like, if somebody who was lower ranking than me just used my last name,
right,
they would be on the ground doing push-ups.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's life at a gas station, man.
all that to say, like, I feel like the phrase dress for the job you want or dress for success.
Right.
Like, I feel like it goes in the same thing. Like if you're not able to acknowledge whether it's a person, whether it's an idea, if you're not able to acknowledge the thing that you're learning from,
Yeah.
That's leading you somewhere to go somewhere better and beyond. Like if you're not able to be able to humble yourself and put yourself below someone, I think that provides an inability to put yourself in a place of learning or humbleness. So in the school district, which I've enjoyed, but in that situation where it's just like, oh, hey, Jeff, like, what are we doing today? No, it's not because of myself. No, that's how they refer to the actual that's staff so teacher. Weird. I'm not looking to be elevated, but in the same sense, like
Mr. and Mrs. first name.
I don't want to be equal to the students in some aspects because, like, I want them to know that, like, I'm giving direction that needs to be followed, not just guidelines that they should go by.
Right.
Like, whereas, like, if I'm talking to someone in a medical facility, doctor, whatever, I'm saying that because, like, I want them to know I'm going to trust you because I know your position. Mm-hmm. I'm underneath your care. In the same way, like, as students, like, I think it's important for students to know they're here, whether it's in a church setting, whether it's like whether any form of respect. And I say student, just anyone that's beneath someone else. So even adult students, like, I think it's important for them to establish that I'm here to learn. I'm here to be led.
Yeah.
Mr., sir, ma'am. So I don't necessarily think, going back to the main question, I don't think there's a direct correlation of the downfall of society to using a pronoun.
Right.
But in the same sense, I think
are those pronouns? Those are titles.
Titles. Yeah. I think there is a lack of elevating ourselves to be a little bit better.
Yeah.
Elevating ourselves to be a little bit more established. Kids in public school wear sweatpants, wear pajama pants, wear crop tops, they wear hats now in schools. Yeah. Like, just like things like that. Like, granted, yeah, clothes doesn't necessarily affect the way they read a book, but in the same sense, are they giving themselves the best effort by preparing themselves and getting their body and their mind ready to be adaptable and to be alert, to be trainable, to learn,
right,
to be absorbent.
Yeah.
Like, I think you dress for the job you want, not the job you have.
Right.
Unless you're at McDonald's and you got to wear the shirt they give you. Like, that's required.
Well, maybe that's the job you want.
Why are you wearing a manager shirt? I want your job.
So. It also gets a little weirder as you get older because, like, my kids are having friends over.
Yeah.
And Jen's totally comfortable having our kids' friends call her Jen. And it's not like a conversation we have. It's one of them called me Nelson. I was like, call me Mr. Nelson.
Oh, you correct? Yeah. You correct.
Okay. And then I've had, like, should I call you Mr. Hicks? I was like, Mr. Nelson's fine. And it's still like, I think that Mr. is necessary. I think part of it is, too, because I look like a kid. I don't dress like most adults.
When I was working at the church, I actually would prefer them just to call me Jeff rather than Pastor Jeff. And it was a minimal time that I had the title of youth pastor or student ministry director. Like, for me, it was just like, just call me Jeff. Like, I have in that setting where, like, I'm trying to have a relationship where it's more intentional. A church relationship is different than a school setting. So, like, I'm almost more preferably in that setting, I'd rather be just Jeff.
Yeah.
Like, I'm okay with Mr. Reddick. But I don't need to be called Pastor Jeff. I don't need to be called Youth Pastor Jeff.
I did have once where I called an older man, I think his first name was Mark or whatever. And he introduced himself, like, how you doing, Mr. Mark? And he says, oh, no, we're Pierce. Just call me Mark. And I was like, sorry, Mr. Mark, but, like, you're old enough to be my grandfather. You have much more experience. And I made the case for, like, it's important to me that he's like, no, Mark will do. And I was like, okay. Yeah. So, and I thought that was interesting. But also, like, so I think it's weird if somebody corrects you up, right? If, like, you say, right, how you doing, Mr. Reddick? They're like, actually, it's Dr. Reddick.
Dr. Mr. Reddick. Sergeant.
Dr. Sergeant Mr. Reddick. Yeah. I think that's weird. Yeah. But, like, if somebody gives you a title of reverence, I think just take it.
Yeah.
But going back to the, is it true? Connor, is it true? Do you think that green hair and bone through your nose is just a short trip away from when you stop hearing ma'am and sir?
Not necessarily. I think that's just personal expression.
Right.
I understand where he's coming from when he says it. Like, as far as saying sir and ma'am, when they stop saying that, in his mind, it's a snowball effect.
Mm-hmm.
and eventually they'll get to that point.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily agree that they correlate, though.
Okay.
I think that you could have green hair and a pierced nose and still respect your elders.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I wouldn't say I necessarily agree with him.
There's a book by Michael Pollan. Do you know who that guy is?
Nope.
Most of the stuff he does.
Is he modern or is this like old?
Modern, okay. Still writing.
Okay.
And he's a journalist and author. And most of his books are about food sustainability.
Oh, okay.
And he just comes from a very interesting angle. Like, he's not a vegetarian. He's not, actually, he might be now. But like, when he went into it, he's like, you know, I eat meat, cheese, all this stuff. Like, is it okay for me to do that? Am I wasting the world's resources? And he went down the rabbit hole, and he comes from a very left of center politics, but through his research came across a guy called Joel Salatin, and the two of them were at this big convention, because there was this they're trying to do this farm to table movement in New York, and so they brought in like 13 of these like brilliant farmers who are doing sustainable farming, and Michael Pollan got to sit in the conversation. And one of the old guys there was an old Mennonite guy. And they were all talking about what tractors they use. And after they were finished talking tractors, he's like, we still use like wagons, because once you put rubber on the tire, it's just a generation left before the kids leave the farm. And like all the other farmers got like really somber and just kind of had this cheering, knowing nod. And in the book, that dovetails into the conversation about how like, something like 60% of the farms in America do not have an inheritor, or the inheritors aren't interested. But just that same kind of concept of like this one specific thing, it's only a short time from that to this other moral decay. And I mean, it's basically slippery slope theory, but like, I don't know. It's just interesting. Like, slippery slope fallacy is also the only one that we say the name of it when we're doing it.
Well, I'm slipping. Yeah, on a slope.
Yeah, but I mean, like, when
with the fallacy
in 2008 when same-sex marriage was legalized, a lot of people said, you know, it's a slippery slope between this and pedophilia. So any thoughts on pedophiles?
I have more to say about the movie, not necessarily at this point.
We can move on. Absolutely.
I think we've wrung that teat dry.
Question for both of you, but primarily you, Jeff, because this is your first time seeing this movie. What did you think of the score?
Honestly, I didn't even notice it.
There's a reason.
Is there not a score?
There isn't one.
Oh. I would say I don't remember one.
There's about...
I thought you were just like baiting me. Like, I actually, like,
yeah.
There's no...
So there's about 11... I think 11 or 17, something like that, minutes of music in this movie.
Really?
And most of that is the credits. The rest of it is just like bells, like Buddhist Zen bells that they would use for dramatic effect.
Really?
But most of the movie, there is absolutely no music. And the only thing that you can hear in the background is the wind.
I did not notice the absence of music in this at all. I did notice when music was present. So the mariachi band. Mm-hmm.
That scene cracked me up.
Did you know what they were saying?
I have it right here.
It's just like the plot of the movie.
Yeah.
You wanted to fly without wings. You wanted to touch the sky. You wanted too much wealth. You wanted to play with fire. So I noticed when there was a song introduced.
Yeah.
But I don't think I ever acknowledged the fact that music was absent.
Jen and I were laughing at that scene just because, like, I think that that's a hilarious... Like, I want to hire a mariachi band to just go play loudly to pass out drunk guys in the street. It's just such a hilarious thing.
So
that's like interesting.
Like I said, most of the time, all you can hear is the wind. Yeah. And I think that there's a reason for that. Now, you guys know I'm not super religious, right? But I think, and especially some of the research that I did for this movie, for the podcast, that there is a correlation between the wind noise and the Bible, especially the book of Ecclesiastes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So why are you smirking at me?
Because I think I know where you're going with this. Okay. And I love this.
So,
because this is not the kind of conversations you and I typically have, Connor.
Correct. So, from what I understand, the Book of Ecclesiastes focuses mostly on death.
Yeah.
Right.
And the meaningless of life.
Yeah. And
the meaninglessness of life.
There's a part at the end of the movie where Sheriff Bell is talking to his uncle or whoever that is, and he starts telling him about how his uncle starts telling him about how the problems of the world aren't all necessarily on him to solve, and that is vanity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there's a part in Ecclesiastes that says, all is vanity and a chasing after the wind.
That's right.
And I think that the reason why most of the time throughout the movie that you hear that wind is that they want you to kind of focus on the meaningless of life.
Meaninglessness.
Sure.
The meaning, yeah, that works. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Focusing on your own vanity, especially with the title of this movie, No Country for Old Men, you're focusing on your personal nostalgia and the way that you view the world
mm-hmm.
from when, you know, you were a kid and how everybody says, oh, back in my day, things were this way or whatever. Mm-hmm. Generally, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at everything through rose-colored glasses. And I think this movie focuses a lot on that death aspect.
Yeah.
And especially with the coin flip, the idea that when we die, we don't necessarily know what comes after, right? Obviously, if you have faith, you believe in,
mm-hmm.
you know, an afterlife and things like that. But in reality, we don't know for sure what happens. And so it's kind of bringing forth the idea that it's better to hedge your bets because there's a 50-50 chance there's something out there or there's not,
mm-hmm.
depending on what you believe. And it's better to try and do good in the world, believe in something, be a good person so that when you die, if there is something, you have that reward. And if there's not, there's no harm done. And I think that goes back to that the coin flip, the wind, Ecclesiastes, all of it kind of coming together as one overarching theme throughout the movie, which is why at the beginning when you said there's all this death that doesn't mean anything, I disagreed with you. I think the death is important.
So it's not that I think that the movie is making a point that death is meaningless. I think that they were trying to make a point in how meaninglessly death happened in the movie, right? Woody Harrelson seems like he's going to be a super important character and killed off, technically off screen.
And very, very quickly after his introduction, too.
Right.
He didn't have much screen time in this movie.
And then Josh Brolin's character also killed off screen.
Off screen.
And I think, and then you've got the 11 dead Mexican drug cartel guys. You've got a bunch of nameless people getting shot in pretty, like, just nothing ways. I think that they were trying to make a point of, it's similar to how some of the movies we've covered in the past, especially war movies, and they just kind of like the nothingnessness of sort of kind of like a everything everywhere all at once type argument of just like none of this matters. It could be gone like that. Is kind of what I was picking up from that, and that the banal deaths serve to make that point. Not that they were saying death itself is meaningless.
But I just found it interesting that there isn't any music, that it's just the sound of the wind.
Yeah.
I think that kind of plays into this sort of biblical undertone.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to get ahead of myself here with my final thoughts of this movie at the with our end-up wrap-up, but that thought alone makes me want to watch this movie again.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't notice it. Like, most movies, I want to say most. There are some movies where I'm like, the music is a part of it. And like, for me, it's a part of the experience. Harry Potter. Like, I love the soundtrack to Harry Potter. Lord of the Rings. Most of Christopher Nolan's movies, because he uses a lot of Hans Zimmer. Like, so for me, there's a lot of films that I'm just as excited for the soundtrack as I am the film. This one, I didn't need the music. Or because I consciously didn't know that I didn't require it because of the way the movie played out. I'm so fascinated by that. I want to watch this again now.
Movies often have terrific scores as well.
I want to watch this again now.
I'd never noticed it.
And try to focus on the fact that there's no music.
When you said, what do you think of the score? I was like, there wasn't one, was there?
I'm glad you mentioned
that. Usually when it's quiet in a movie, you'd notice. And this one is just kind of like...
Yeah, I never once thought about the score in this movie. I never required it.
Do you have additional topics you want to go over? I've got one left.
I have one, but it kind of goes into the end of the movie, and I think it might tie into what Jeff said at the beginning, where he wasn't thrilled with the ending or didn't understand or just kind of left it ambiguous. Mm-hmm. So we can get into that toward the end
if you want. Well, I got one left. We'll do that then wrap up. Or do you have anything
left? I don't have anything else.
Okay. I can't remember who said this to who. He says, if the rule you followed brought you to this, then of what use was the rule?
Anton Chigurh said that to Woody Harrelson's character.
Right. That's right. If the rule you followed brought you to this, then of what use was the rule?
Everything. Because, like, he wouldn't be there if it wasn't for the rule.
But the rule brought him to his death.
I still think that, like, plays into the whole Anton Chigurh is not a real person and the entire reason he's there is to represent chaos.
Right. But, like, we're all on track to our death. Not to be, like, super existential and, like, philosophical, but, like, all of our choices in our life revolve around the fact of either our legacy, what we leave behind, mm-hmm. or us trying to prevent us having an untimely death. Mm-hmm. Like, all of our choices and actions have something to do with humanity and life and living, whether it's the removal of or the adding to.
Yeah.
But, like, so, like, I think it's a very vague statement.
Right. And depends, but, like, it also depends largely on your rules. Right?
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot, Firefly, I know you've not seen it yet.
I've seen a bunch of Fireflies. Summertime, like, my daughter loves catching them.
So there's a line in a jar, Firefly,
shake them up.
Your main character in Firefly,
lightning bugs,
Captain Malcolm, he's was part of the army that lost a civil war in the universe. And somebody said something about him being on the losing side and of the war, and he said, I might have been on the losing side, but I'm not convinced I was on the wrong side. And that kind of comes back to this whole, what use was the rule if it brought you to this? Well, just because the rule brought me here doesn't mean it was a bad rule.
Right.
It might have been a very good rule still. And it'd be in serving with of that rule to see this at the end.
Right. I've followed many lines of, you know, journeys of, you know, chosen choices that have gotten me to places. And the journey itself has been terrible, but the outcome was life-changing and life-giving. Mm-hmm. So, like...
But this one is the opposite.
Right. But, like, but flip that. What if the journey to the end was nothing but life?
Yeah.
Was nothing but fulfillment. Was nothing but enjoyment and establishment and just fulfilled curiosity. Like, what if you met the end and went... If this is it, then the journey here, I'm happy with.
So I guess it depends on what the rule is, and also what the this is that you're being brought to.
It's very vague. It's very vague.
Yeah.
Which for the movie it works,
right?
And like, I was struggled with the ending, but in the same sense for the now second movie that I'm very familiar with of Coen Brothers, in like, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I remember enough.
Yeah.
The ending fit for what I was expecting. Like, I had low expectations for this movie, being that I didn't enjoy Fargo. Mm-hmm. This movie exceeded. Maybe it's why I enjoyed it so much, because, like, I had low expectations.
Right.
Because of what I do and do not like to enjoy. Mm-hmm. So the ending, it didn't ruin my expectations of the film. It was just, oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. No one really gets a happy ending in Coen Brothers films.
No, not usually.
But now, I mean... Even Tommy Lee Jones, like, he went through a lot of tragedy.
Yeah.
To end up where he was. And
he doesn't seem to be enjoying retirement.
Right. So I don't think anyone got a happy ending.
Yeah.
But in the sense, not everyone died.
Connor, your thoughts on if the rule you followed brought you to this, then of what use was the rule?
I don't know if I necessarily have anything to say about the line itself. I did write that line down. Mm. I just think it plays into like I said earlier, the whole idea that Anton Chigurh is just chaos.
Basically, like, you followed rules and it was meaningless because you're going
to
die. Because
everything was left up to chance at that point. Yeah.
Do you think he represents nihilism or just chaos?
Maybe a bit of both. Nihilism seems to be a theme in Coen Brothers movies as well.
Can I?
It's the entire point of The Big Lebowski.
Right.
Can I get a quick definition, if it's possible, of nihilism?
Everything is meaningless.
Like just legitimately, everything is meaningless.
Yep.
Okay. Nihilism. Okay. I would almost disagree with nihilism with Fargo. Like, the cop in Fargo, like, she went back to the life that she was working on. So
I don't think the Coen brothers are nihilists.
Okay.
I think they like using it as a
There's narrative. Elements.
Yeah, I think they like it for narrative.
But for every character to go through a nihilistic event, I don't think that's truth. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Because one of the responses to nihilism, and I can't think of the term for it, but it's like just to choose to enjoy the simple things then.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is what she represented in that movie.
Yeah.
Just going to the end of the movie, you said that nobody has a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that Sheriff Bell's ending is fairly optimistic.
Okay.
And that goes into the description that he was telling his wife, the two dreams that he had.
Mm.
One of those dreams, he was saying that he was riding a horse through the mountains with his father, and his father had fire that he was carrying with him to light his way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys have read The Road at all.
I have.
Another Cormac McCarthy book.
The movie when it came out.
Okay. I'm not familiar with either.
All right. So the story of The Road is essentially a father and a son that are making their way through a post-apocalyptic world. And at one point in the movie, the son asks the father, is what they're doing worth it, trying to get to wherever they're trying to go, right? And all this, the struggle and everything that they're going through just to accomplish their task.
Yeah.
And the father says, the world is dark and we need people who will carry the torch and move the world forward, right? It's paraphrasing, but that's essentially what he says. One of the things that Cormac McCarthy likes to do in his books...
Liked to do.
Okay.
He passed July of this year.
Yeah.
Or June of last year.
Okay. I've read a couple of his books. And one of the things that he likes to do is take a narrative point or a theme from one of his books and carry it into the next one as if it's almost a spiritual sequel.
Okay.
And he wrote The Road before he wrote No Country for Old Men.
Okay.
So he kind of used that theme in this movie to show the growth of Sheriff Bell, the main character, right? He starts out the movie narrating and waxing nostalgic about this previous time in his life when he looked up to all the old men and the world was the way that he thought that it was. And he realizes as the movie goes on that he's trying to essentially just take the torch that was passed along to him and carry it along for the next generation to try and make the world a better place. That he can't solve everybody's problems, but he can at least make it as good as possible while he's here for the next generation. And I think that's kind of what he's saying at the end of the movie when he's talking about the dream that he had with his father and the fire. And he goes to his uncle and he starts talking about everything that he's been trying to do. And his uncle tells him that he can't solve the world's problems, that that's vanity. I think that the ending itself is sort of a happy ending for him, because he gets that realization. And I think that also plays into the whole Anton Chigurh might not be a real person, might just be an agent of chaos, a representation of that, that he was really chasing the cartel that was chasing Llewellyn, and he did the best that he could, but he couldn't save everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That was my interpretation of the end.
I can't disagree with that.
Have you read the book that this is based on?
I haven't read No Country for Old Men. I've read The Road.
Okay. I'm curious if your theory does better or worse in the novelization.
From what I understand, other than a few changes that they made for, like, you know, that one scene where they took the was out to make the line more impactful, most of the dialogue in this movie are direct quotes from the book.
Wow.
This is not a dialogue-heavy film.
No.
But when there is dialogue, it's not. And I noticed that with Fargo as well, too. Like, every phrase, every conversation was intentionally meticulous. And, like,
also,
like, it's like,
yeah, they're very intentional yeah. in the construction. Of the, yeah.
So I appreciated that as well. Going back to back between this and Fargo, like,
yeah.
This one, I was like, oh, they're not talking much. Like, this is just a lot of, like, but in general, like, but when they talk, I'm like, this is valuable. Like,
there's also almost no editing that they did for this movie. Almost really? Everything that they shot is in the movie.
Huh. All right, let's wrap it up.
Let's wrap it up.
All right, gentlemen. 2007's No Country for Old Men. Would you guys recommend this film?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yep, me too. All around. To anyone specific or like a category specific or just in general, like, is this a film that anybody that enjoys movies would like? Just to kind of to break this down a little bit further.
Yeah, but it's still not like I would. If somebody says I'm going to watch No Country for Old Men, I'd say that's excellent. And then I'd say you should also check out, and I would say other Coen Brothers movies that I think are better than it.
What's your number one Coen Brothers film that you've seen?
Yeah, I think it might be Fargo for
okay.
me.
Okay.
Your opinion is wrong, but that's fine.
Yeah. What do you think? Best Coen Brothers.
I haven't seen that many Coen Brothers films, if I'm honest. Oh. I've seen Fargo. I've seen this. I've seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
I've seen clips. I haven't seen the entire thing.
That's good.
I think for like the Coen Brothers movies I've seen.
Actually, better than Fargo is Raising Arizona.
Which was their first one.
Yeah.
Right? That was their first
one. I also haven't seen that.
Yeah.
As far as the Coen Brothers movies I've seen, this is my favorite. Okay.
I haven't seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou recently enough of the three I've seen to give it a fair
yeah.
judgment. But I do know I love, like, music for me is a huge part. Like, the soundtrack for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was amazing.
Who doesn't love the Soggy like, Bottom Boys?
George yeah. Clooney is like
Soggy Bottom Boys.
It's like I just the way I get excited about talking about that film.
Yeah.
I feel like this would be number two
it's of a great the three movie.
I've seen.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, I haven't seen it recent enough to give it a fair judgment. Like, I need to watch that movie again.
I think Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is 100% a more quotable movie than this one.
Oh, 100%. Mm-hmm. 100%. Even more than Fargo. I think there's way more lines in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou that's quotable
oh, sure.
than Fargo is. Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, you betcha.
I don't want fuck. God damn it. I'm a Dapper Dan man.
I ain't want no fuck.
Would you change the ratings? Rated R?
No.
Nope.
Nah, it wouldn't take much to make it TV friendly. There's not much language in this movie.
It's almost all violent.
Yeah. There's minimal. I don't even know if there's an F-bomb in this movie.
I think there was.
There was? Okay. If it's definitely not a frequent word.
I don't remember
any. There's no sexual. There's no nudity.
Yeah.
It's like, it wouldn't take much for them to edit it for TV quality,
yeah,
but it's definitely rated R,
yeah.
For sure. Like the violence and just
and I think it works well as R.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree.
2007, has this movie aged well?
I think it's aged really well.
Almost 16 years? What's the math on that?
Don't remind me, I was in high school still.
Me too.
Yeah, 16. This movie's 16 years old.
We graduated together, Nelson.
Yeah, no, it doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't show its age.
No, but I also think that it in many ways feels like especially some of the highway scenes, like cinematic shots, feels very like a lot like Fargo. And so it almost in some ways makes it feel like it was filmed in a different era, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's a period piece. Period pieces usually hold up.
Well, yeah, but so was Fargo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But barely. Yeah.
No, I like the age, I like the setting of this movie. Like I think yeah. I think it's definitely for the last 16 years it's a good age. Would this be in your personal top 250? Now, Connor, you already answered this. Or one of you already answered this.
He did.
I think it would be, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think it'd be top 50, but it'd be in the top 250.
Mm. I think it's on track to be in my top 250. It's definitely not in my top, like, it's not the top half, but I think it's on track to be in there. Last question here, which we've added since we've had you on the show. Why do you think this is on the top 250? What makes this movie IMDb top 250 worthy.
I think it's the direction and the theming and the acting all combined. I think it's an incredible job. There's a reason why Javier Bardem won an Oscar for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now knowing the soundtrack situation of the film, that kind of ramps this up, the fact that like they eliminated an element that a lot of movies rely on to get this movie to emit an emotion or an experience. And they admitted that to switch it out with something else. That excites me. I really want to watch this movie again. Just for the sheer audio fact, the acting is spot on. It's not a choppy story. The story moves in a nice, like it's fluid. It feels like it's not a struggled storyline. Like, so I appreciate the tempo of the movie. I think the characters are well developed. Like, I think like this is not my favorite movie of all time, but like I can't find any qualms in it. So like, so for that reason, like I think everything is done really well in a manner that deserves high praise.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's a cop out, but like, I liked every aspect of this movie, and I'm very curious to watch it without knowing the audio situation.
Yeah. I would put it in my top five Coen Brothers movies. I think it's...
You've only seen two, so no, I'm just kidding.
I've seen almost all of them.
It's top five, and I've only seen two.
I've seen almost all of them. Yeah. I wouldn't put it in my top five, even. I think it's got elements of everything that Coen Brothers do well. So, for me, it's kind of odd that this one is on the top 250 when others aren't.
Is Raising Arizona on the top 250?
I'm not sure. Let me double check.
Okay.
Is The Big Lebowski?
It is.
That's interesting.
I'm not familiar with that at all.
That movie.
That is, for audience Rotten Tomatoes, that's the best Coen Brothers movie.
I know that movie.
John Goodman and White Russians. I don't know anything else about it. And Bowling. Those are the only two things I know about that film.
While he's looking this up, I have one more fun fact that I know about this movie. So the Coen Brothers like to edit their own movies.
Yes.
They
write, direct, and edit their own movies.
The Academy wanted to nominate this movie for its editing. But they will not recognize multiple editors. You have to have one main editor for the movie.
Are you serious? Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't use both Coen brothers, and they couldn't decide on which one would get the accolade for it.
So they nominated each of them?
No. They both came up with a fake name for the editor of this movie. And then when they announced it at the Academy Awards as a nominee for best editor or whatever the category is, They said the fake person that the Coen brothers made up and just showed a stock image of an old man.
Did they end up winning it?
I don't believe so.
I love that.
That's funny. So
that's so petty for like the awards committee to be like, no, only one. We can't talk. No teams. Only one. Like that's so petty.
There are only three currently on the top 250. No Country for Old Men, Fargo, The Big Lebowski.
Okay.
No Country for Old Men, its highest rank was 14. Fargo's was 15. Big Lebowski, the highest it's ever been, was 126.
Okay. So we've done the top two.
Yes. The following have been, and I'll say their highest rank at the same time, True Grit, 184. Okay. The Man Who Wasn't There, 188. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, 157. Blood Simple, 179. Raising Arizona, 185.
Oh, okay.
Hudsucker Proxy, 230. Miller's Crossing, 100. I think Raising Arizona is probably my favorite of the Coen Brothers
productions. Is that a crime thriller or is that more of a dark comedy?
Yeah, it's crime.
It's crime, okay.
It's a dark comedy crime.
Okay. More in line with like the Fargo.
It's more Fargo than it is.
Than it is.
Yeah. And Big Lebowski is going to be more Fargo than it is No Country for Old Men.
But that's also a mobster type movie, right? Big Lebowski, like I get like mob vibes from that movie.
Wait and see.
Okay.
So is Fargo rated higher than this movie on the top 250?
What's its current rating? No Country for Old Men, what's it currently at? Do you remember?
No, but I can look it up.
I'll have it here in a second. Don't worry about it.
Because I'm on the Jeff train with Fargo. I think it's an okay movie, but it's not something that I'm like, I gotta rewatch this.
Right.
It feels like it's just on the top 250 for its cultural significance.
As of recording, Fargo was number 171.
Today?
No. When we recorded it, Fargo was at 171, which was only a couple weeks ago.
That's actually where it is today.
Okay. And then No Country for Old Men is 147. So No Country for Old Men is their highest. I'm bleeding.
Okay. Where's Big Lebowski right now?
Where are you bleeding from? I'm a medic.
My nose. Not my eye. Not my eye.
Big Lebowski today is at 209. Fargo is the only one that has 100% on the top 250. So No Country for Old Men didn't come on to the top 250 until a little bit after it had already been out. But no, I think Raising Arizona is better. It's more like Fargo, though. It's more comedy. Man Who Wasn't There, if you just like their serious crime stuff, Man Who Wasn't There is a really great Coen Brothers like hard-boiled crime. It's got Sling Blade in it and Black Widow.
I think you're getting... Those are different movies. So you're saying that movie...
I just want to say thank you for having me.
Yeah, oh, it's always a pleasure.
This episode is never going to air, but yeah, we're glad to have you. Well,
thanks for inviting me for a movie that wasn't military themed. I appreciate that.
I mean, he was in Vietnam, and we didn't talk about that. What are we doing next week, Jeff?
The Passion of Joan of Arc, 1928.
1928. This is like a 5-hour silent film, right?
2-hour silent film.
That was close.
Yeah, it's about a boat, I think.
Yeah.
An arc. That holds Jones.
Mm. This is probably where the legend of Davy Jones' locker comes from.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And witches. There's probably witches involved in this movie.
You guys are both fathers and it shows.
Thank you. That's the highest compliment anyone's ever given me. Happy New Year. Connor, thanks for having
me on the show. Happy New Year.
This probably won't be the last time, but thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me again.
And thank you for your service. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did.
If you have found value in what we discussed today, please consider leaving us a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.
If you have any feedback or suggestions, we would love to hear from you.
That's right. Tell us why we're wrong.
If you want even more content and ways to engage with us and each other, check out our Patreon page.
By supporting us there, you'll get access to exclusive bonus content and help us continue to create high quality episodes, as well as help pay for our future plans. Links to our social media, merchandise, and Patreon are in the show notes.